Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
Well, politicians in the Bay Area and beyond are remembering Ron Dellums, a former congressman and mayor of Oakland, who died today of cancer at age 82. Dellums was known for his relentless focus on social justice. It was thanks to his leadership that America finally took steps to help the cause of Nelson Mandela. KPIX5's Jackie Ward gives us a look back.
Ronald Verney Dellums started his political career as a member of the Berkeley City Council. Eventually, he'd be elected to serve as a member of the House of Representatives from 1971 to 1998, where he co-founded the Black Caucus and became the first African-American to chair the Armed Services Committee. As a congressman, Dellums took the lead in the fight against apartheid rule in South Africa.
Bay Area, let us welcome Nelson Mandela!
His work led to U.S. sanctions against South Africa and cemented his friendship with Nelson Mandela.
The people of Oakland, the people of the Bay Area, who have given me and my delegation strength and hope to go back and continue the struggle.
Dellums was later honored by that country with a special award for his efforts. In 2007, Dellums would become the city of Oakland's 48th mayor.
You had retired from politics. Did you ever expect to be back in it like this?
No, I can say very honestly, no.
Current mayor Libby Schaff says as a kid growing up in Oakland, she admired what he said and how he fought for change.
He was someone who came out of the Oakland community and rose to this incredible place of power without ever compromising his moral fiber, without ever compromising his absolute beliefs in what was justice.
Mayor Schaff has asked that all flags be flown at half staff today, including here at the federal building named in his honor. In Oakland, Jackie Ward, KPIX 5.
And Congresswoman Barbara Lee, who took over Dellums' seat, said in a statement today, quote, "I will miss him tremendously, and I will hold dear to my heart the many lessons I learned from this great public servant." And former President Bill Clinton tweeted this, "Ron Dellums, quote, spoke truth to power and appealed to America's conscience in championing those who were left out and left behind, whether in the East Bay, across the nation, or around the world." Plans for a memorial service are still pending.
One day I was walking down a block. I had my cut-off shorts on, right? Because it was crazy hot. I walked past these dudes when they passed me. One of them felt my booty. He was nasty. Yeah. I turned around red. Somebody was catching the rat. Then the little one said,
yeah, me, bitch.
And laughed. Since he was with his boys, he tried to break the block. I punched him dead in his eyes. Said,
who you calling
a
bitch?
Julie Lalonde has been listening in on our conversation so far. She's the director of Hollaback Ottawa, a local chapter of a global movement to end street harassment. And she joins us from our studio in Ottawa. Hello.
Hello.
Now, before I ask you about your thoughts on the Nottinghamshire model, what did you think when you saw the video out of Paris this week?
I wasn't surprised either. Unfortunately, versions of that happen every day around the world. We were lucky in this case that not only was there CCTV coverage, but also that the woman was willing to come forward and talk about her experience. But unfortunately, it is painfully common for versions of that to happen.
In Nottingham, the onus is still on women to come forward and report the incidents, as we've just heard. But research is showing that the policy of treating misogynistic harassment as a hate crime seems to be helping women feel safer in that city. What do you make of the approach?
I think I'm a big believer that communities should decide what's best for them. So a few years ago, Peru did something similar where its street harassment is illegal in Peru as well. Hollaback movement globally and here in Ottawa, we don't advocate for a criminal justice response to street harassment. First, we know that most forms of street harassment are already a crime in Canada. You can't follow someone, you can't threaten someone, you can't grab somebody without their consent. But more than that, our concern is that conversations around street harassment turn racist really fast. And the perception is that it is men of color, immigrant men, street-involved men, men from poor neighborhoods who engage in street harassment. And so our fear with legislation, creating new legislation, is that it's going to result in higher levels of policing of certain neighborhoods and ignoring the fact that here in Ottawa, for example, you're as likely to be street harassed walking through campus, walking by Parliament Hill, as you are in a neighborhood that is deemed a poor neighborhood. So that's our concern with legislative responses to street harassment.
It will lead in some way to racial profiling. A couple of years ago, you conducted a survey about women's experience with harassment. What did that survey tell you about the scale of the problem in Ottawa?
Well, 97% of the people who filled out our survey had an experience of street harassment in the past year. They were all women or non-binary folks. And something that wasn't picked up as much by the media but was really shocking to me was that the average age of the respondent was 29, and yet a third of our respondents said that as a result of street harassment, they don't go outside alone at night. Mm-hmm. A third had said that they don't go to, if they were experiencing harassment in a certain neighborhood or on a certain bus route, that they'll avoid that route moving forward. I mean, these are grown women who are curtailing their everyday lives as a result of harassment that they've experienced, a very valid fear based on past experience. That's not okay that women are not able to access public space in the way that men are, for example.
Why haven't you learned anything?
A treasure trove of documents about Harvard University's admission process is revealing secrets about how America's oldest university selects its students. A federal court has unsealed hundreds of admissions applications and documents in recent weeks as part of a lawsuit alleging the university discriminates against Asian American applicants. The court papers shed light on how the university considers an applicant's socioeconomic status, race, or personality to give preference on who gets in. The lawsuit could have important implications for affirmative action. And joining us now to discuss what we're learning from these new documents is Anna Mona Hartikolis from the New York Times. Welcome.
Thank you, Elsa.
So you've been poring through all of these documents produced by Harvard University about its admissions process. I'm curious, what struck you as particularly damning for the university's case? Was there anything?
Yes, I and two of my colleagues have read hundreds of documents. And one of the things that has stood out for me is something that Harvard calls lopping, which, according to the court papers, takes place at the end of the admissions process when the admissions office looks at the racial balance of the class and adjusts it.
So race is the determinative factor for who gets lopped from the list at the very end.
Well, that's a good question. I think that that's what the plaintiffs want to find out.
There was this other phrase that came up, and that was tipping or to tip. What does that mean?
A tip, as I discovered through a document in the files, a Department of Education investigation in the late 80s, is a preference. And it is given to certain categories of applicants, according to the plaintiffs. And those would include racial and ethnic minorities and kids whose parents graduated from Harvard and recruited athletes, among others.
Though, at the end of the day, Harvard admits somewhere around 2,000 students per year. And if you look at the academic records of the students applying, it's pretty overwhelming. There are way more than 2,000 applicants year after year who have perfect SAT scores and straight A's. So Harvard can't let them all in either. It does need to have other criteria to select students. I guess, does this fight come down to whether Harvard is using the correct criteria?
I think it comes down to whether Harvard is misusing its criteria. I think Harvard probably has a large degree of discretion. The Supreme Court has ruled that universities have a large degree of discretion in deciding whom to admit, but that they cannot treat different groups in a disparate way. And the charge here is that Asians are being treated differently because of their race from everybody else.
And what is Harvard's best argument to that?
First of all, Harvard strenuously denies any discrimination and says that its admission system is a carefully calibrated way of curating an ideal class that will help shape the future of a pluralistic society in America.
Anna Mona Hardikolis covers higher education for The New York Times. Thanks very much for joining us.
You're welcome, Elsa.
LeBron James, when he came out for warm-ups, the crowd was here early. They booed him every time he touched the ball in warm-ups. I've never seen that.
That was a nice twist.
King James may be moving away from Ohio, but not before making a special kind of investment in his hometown. LeBron James and the city of Akron, Ohio, partnered up to build a public school called I Promise. It's meant to serve at-risk kids. The I Promise school opened this week. Brandi Davis is the school's principal, and she joins us now. Ms. Davis, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Describe the first day of school when students and parents showed up into this new space.
The first day of school was like a huge pep rally the entire day. We tried our best to have the most normal day for our students, but that was pretty difficult.
Right.
Tons of media outside, entrances blocked off. There was a huge stage in front of the school. And, I mean, really, in actuality, how can you have a normal day
right.
when the best basketball player in the world is at your building, walking around, touring with media. It was a great stage show.
Cool.
It was just an amazing atmosphere. Tears, excitement, joy for what's to come.
So just describe what makes this school different. I mean, clearly beyond the fact that LeBron James is the benefactor, what are these kids going to get as a result of being students there?
The I Promise School is unique because not only are we a STEM-designated school by the state of Ohio, but we have trauma-informed support because we are truly into educating the entire child, the whole child, focusing not just on their academics but also on their social-emotional needs as well. And then I feel the missing link in public education is family wraparound supports.
Mm.
We have a family resource center housed on the premises of our school because we're not only into nurturing and loving our students, but we are wrapping our arms around the entire family, ensuring that we're providing all of the supports that they need.
We should just tick off a few of these specific benefits. I mean, parents who need the support will get support to complete a GED. They will get help finding a job if they need it. Students are going to get free meals there. The tuition to the school is obviously free.
And, yes, it is a public school, Akron Public School.
And they will get free college tuition if they graduate from high school at the University of Akron. That's huge.
Absolutely, absolutely. We are providing that solid foundation so that our students are not only strong academically, but they are contributing members of our society as well.
Well, then let me ask you big picture. This has happened before, that a well-meaning individual, celebrity maybe, maybe not, or foundations with money have put cash into schools for at-risk kids, and results have been mixed. What has to happen to make sure that I Promise is a success over the long term?
It's a true long-standing partnership. Akron Public Schools and the LeBron James Family Foundation already has a withstanding partnership since 2011. And just having everyone sitting at the table, making decisions and all working together for the goodness or the best way possible for these students to learn, that is what it's all about. At the end of the day, it's all about our students and what works best for them.
Brandi Davis is the principal of the I Promise School in Akron, Ohio. Ms. Davis, thanks so much for being here. Have a great school year.
Thanks. Thanks so much.
Book review, Kelly's Hammer and Hoe. Noted historian and public intellectual Robin D.J. Kelly is brilliant, productive, and talented. But all this could be seen in the beginning of his career, a quarter of a century ago, when the University of North Carolina Press published Hammer and Hoe, Alabama Communists During the Great Depression. By Alabama Communists, Kelly means, for the most part, black Alabamans, workers, miners, agricultural workers, trade unionists, who struggled through the 1930s to build a communist party against the forces of the armed state and fascist right-wing terrorists who beat, shot, assaulted, raped, and murdered people, who tried to unite and fight for better wages and a better way of life. Who knew that there were hundreds, possibly thousands, of black communists organizing in Alabama during the 1930s? Well, Robin D.G. Kelly did. And his book is nothing short of a revelation. This hidden, little-known history of black revolutionaries organizing at a time of fascist reaction in America, and especially Alabama, is what I call underground history. History lived at a high level of resistance, seldom reported, and afterwards all but forgotten, reminds us that black history is often revolutionary history, yet it is rarely acknowledged as such. Kelly's usage of personal interviews with former party members, his study of union newsletters and files of groups active during the Depression, gives us valuable insights into how revolutionary black life was lived during times of arch repression. Sometimes, a book comes along that transforms our thinking of how history is understood. For example, Herbert Apthecker's American Negro Slave Revolts, or C.L.R. James' Black Jacobins on the Haitian Revolution, changed everything that preceded it, as well as all that followed. Robin D.G. Kelly's remarkable work, Hammer and Hoe, originally published in 1990 from Imprisoned Nation. This is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
The Trump effect and how it spreads. It says we are on the brink under Trump. On the brink of fascism. New York Times, all the news that's fit to print, editorial 12/10/2015. I say fascism is end stage white supremacy. See, just like in Nazi Germany. Fascism, system of racism, white supremacy, determined to survive.
The rage and violence that marked the Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville, Virginia, a year ago was, to many, an alarming sign of the growth of militant white power organizations in America. There were violent street clashes, and one woman was killed when a young man drove a car into a crowd of anti-racist protesters. Our guest, journalist A.C. Thompson, was in Charlottesville that day and has been reporting on hate groups for more than a year. He's followed up on white power groups that were in Charlottesville and has identified individual members who engaged in the violence, including one active duty Marine. A.C. Thompson is a correspondent for Frontline PBS and a staff reporter for ProPublica. His stories, which often focus on the criminal justice system, helped lead to the exoneration of two San Francisco men sentenced to life in prison and the prosecution of seven New Orleans police officers after Hurricane Katrina. Thompson's reporting is featured in a Frontline and ProPublica joint investigation, Documenting Hate Charlottesville, which premieres Tuesday night on PBS stations. Well, A.C. Thompson, welcome to Fresh Air. You know, you covered the Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville last year and the violence that accompanied it. And you'd been reporting on hate groups and their crimes before. So I'm not quite sure what you were expecting, but I'm wondering what surprised you about what you saw?
You know, I think the thing that surprised me the most was the lack of effective response by the police department. So up to the Charlottesville rally, we had seen one bloody, violent street fight after another in major American cities. So the extreme right wing and the fascists and neo-Nazis would come out. They would be met by their political opponents. There would be brawls. There would be stabbings. There would be mayhem. And I thought by the time we get to Charlottesville, the police are going to be prepared for this. They're going to know to keep these two groups separate. They're going to know to tell people, hey, don't bring clubs, don't bring knives, don't bring helmets and pepper spray. And they're going to take that stuff away from people. And it's not going to be chaos. And I was completely wrong, completely wrong.
Right. And as I recall, the authorities said, well, they were prevented from taking some measures that they had planned on implementing, like separating the groups. Do they have any defense here?
So after Charlottesville, the city commissioned a 200-page report to look into what went wrong. And I've been reporting on police for about 20 years, and I honestly have never seen anything like it. The report is absolutely damning. And it basically says the local Charlottesville police let people fight it out and just stood around. And they basically decided it would be easier to declare an unlawful assembly and clear them out after there had been a bunch of bloodshed. And that is exactly what we witnessed. But to realize that this seems to have been the police department's plan or something that they intended rather than a breakdown in communication or some kind of major foul-up is pretty stunning to me.
Jason Kessler, I guess, was the guy who called for this Unite the Right rally. And the idea was we're really going to bring all of these white power groups together in one place and have a demonstration of strength. I'm wondering if you were surprised by the number that showed up. And do we know how many showed up?
I don't think anybody has a good number on how many showed up, but definitely hundreds and possibly approaching 1,000 on the white power side. You know, one thing that I think that many observers don't really get is that these groups were very well organized in many ways. They operated in a sort of paramilitary fashion. They had leaders and commanders who were directing the members of the groups where to go and what to do, and those members followed those orders. And, for example, on August 11th, the night of the infamous torch march, all those groups showed up, hundreds of people, in a little field next to the UVA grounds, in a matter of moments. They just materialized out of nowhere, formed up, formed a line, and started marching. And it was a really remarkable display of tactical efficiency.
When you saw this hand-to-hand violence in Charlottesville, I'm wondering, could you just describe the two sides? Were they evenly skilled, organized, prepared, matched?
So the first thing to know is the violence starts on August 11th, and that's the night of the torch march on the University of Virginia. And during that march, the white supremacists were really aggressive, really menacing. I mean, they told me, we're going to put you in a camp. They said that to myself and my camera person. They were incredibly hostile, and they just basically went crazy and attacked this very small group of anti-racist counter-protesters and students. When you come to the next day, the 12th, the first thing of the day that I remember was a guy in a swastika t-shirt pushing around an African-American photographer and basically getting physical with this photographer. And throughout the day, you just saw one escalating incident after another. There was a contingent of militant anti-fascists who were throwing stuff at the Nazis and the white supremacists. And by stuff, I mean tear gas canisters, urine, bottles, all kinds of things like that. And then there were all kinds of white supremacists who had guns in some cases, who had clubs, who had flagpoles that they were using to beat people with. And these two groups came together in a whole different series of clashes. I would say, to my eyes, the militant anti-fascist group looked much smaller than the white supremacist group and, frankly, less skilled at physical altercations. And I should also say, you know, there was a large contingent, probably the overwhelming contingent on the anti-racist side, that day in Charlottesville who didn't want to have anything to do with any violence and had no plans to engage in violence and didn't engage in violence.
There was the tragic death of Heather Heyer in that attack by James Alex Fields, who allegedly drove his car in. There was obviously a lot of violence and a lot of coverage that followed. And I'm wondering, in the weeks and months afterward, what were the unanswered questions that you wanted to pursue?
For me, one thing I wanted to know is, who were these people? You know, where did they come from? How did they become adherents to these various white supremacist ideologies? What had they come there to do? And who had committed crimes, essentially, and gotten away with it? I wanted to know who was responsible for the violence that day and what had happened to them in the weeks and months after the event.
Right. And we know that James Alex Field was charged with driving a car into the crowd. Were others prosecuted?
You know, there was a small handful of prosecutions that came out of August 11th and August 12th. So some of the men responsible for attacking DeAndre Harris in the parking garage, he was an African-American man who was really, really severely beaten by a group of white supremacists. Some of those men have been prosecuted. He was, in fact, prosecuted for assault and acquitted, with the police theorizing that it was a mutual combat situation. There were a handful of prosecutions, but not very many.
You know, after the Charlottesville violence, Donald Trump said things like, you know, there were bad things done by people on all sides, and there were good people on both sides. I'm wondering what the reaction was among the white power movement to those comments.
I think, from the people I've spoken to, that they took heart in the president's comments, that they were inspired by the president's comments, that they felt like he was giving them a nod and giving them a pat on the back and saying, you know, I can't fully embrace your cause, but I'm going to give you this sort of tacit approval here, or low-key approval, I would say. Not tacit, explicit. And they were heartened by that. I mean, in our film, you can see David Duke and Matthew Heimbach, who at the time was the leader of a large neo-Nazi group, praising the president and saying, you know, look, he opened a door for us. He's giving us credit, and explicitly saying, like, hey, you know, this guy's on our side.
Well, let's talk about some of the follow-up that you did on participants. You write about a group called the Rise Above Movement. Where are they based? What do they do?
So the Rise Above Movement is based in Southern California, and they have members sort of from San Diego to Los Angeles. And they're a new white supremacist group that formed in 2017, and they're sort of like a post-skinhead group. They have incorporated many members of the nation's largest and most violent Nazi skinhead gang, the Hammerskins, but they don't wear shaved heads. They don't do the skinhead costume with the bomber jackets and the Doc Martin boots. They look like jocks. They look like guys you might see rooting for a football team or at a mixed martial arts event. And their sort of thing is they clearly are white supremacists, and they definitely identify with fascist ideology, but they want to be a little more subtle and not put the swastika on everything and not put overt Nazi symbolism on everything, and try to pull in members by saying, hey, look, we're nationalists, we're patriots, we're healthy young men. We want a traditional white American way of life, and sort of downplay the fascist and white supremacist stuff.
Right. On the other hand, when there are opportunities for mixing it up in the street, like, for example, at a Trump rally, I guess, in March 2017, they come ready to rumble, right?
In my view, the Rise Above Movement are the most effective street fighters that we've seen emerge out of the white supremacist movement in the last couple of years. These are the guys who show up to these events, show up to these rallies, and actually know how to fight, and actually do it very effectively, and do it essentially in formation. And I really haven't seen that out of most of the other groups. These guys are fairly fearsome when you see them on the streets.
You and others at ProPublica, I gather, looked at a lot of video from Charlottesville and earlier confrontations at which people from the Rise Above movement were there and active. And you've identified one guy that we see in the documentary. I think Michael Macellus is his name, right? Tell us about him.
So Michael Macellus is a guy who came on our radar first when we were looking through footage of confrontations in Charlottesville. And we saw this young man who looked like he was an associate of the Rise Above movement. He was dressed like they were. He was engaged in throwing full cans of soda and rocks at people. He was engaged in fisticuffs in Charlottesville. But we didn't have a name for him, and we didn't know who he was. We just thought he was a Rise Above movement associate. And as we did more and more reporting, it became clear, hey, he's definitely a member of the group, and he's definitely been active in altercations, not just in Charlottesville, but also in Berkeley, California in 2017. But the surprising thing to us was not that he was involved in these violent conflicts. We knew that. The surprising thing was that he was an aerospace engineer and was pursuing his PhD at UCLA in aerospace engineering, and that he was working for Northrop Grumman with a security clearance, apparently working on next-generation military technology.
And so when you figured out who he was, you obviously made an effort to contact him. What happened?
So we went to see him at his house. It took us a while to find him. And we wanted to be sure that he was the right guy, that he was the person that we thought he was. And Macellus denied being in Charlottesville. He denied being a member of the Rise Above movement. And he said that to us on the camera in a very sort of unshocked tone, I would say. But what was interesting after that is the group claimed him. And they said, hey, Mike Macellus did nothing wrong. Yeah, he's a member of RAM. Yeah, you should support him. We're going to do a legal fundraiser for him. So the guy who's telling us one minute he's not a member of the group, after he gets named in our story, loses his job at Northrop Grumman, suddenly acknowledges that, yes, he's a member of the group, and could you help me out with my current situation?
When you looked at those engaging in violence at Charlottesville, you discovered that one of them appeared to be a lance corporal in the Marine Corps. Tell us about this fellow, how you figured this out.
The person in question is a young man named Vasilius Pistolis. And what happened was we got access to 250,000 messages that were sent by members of what is definitely a neo-Nazi group, a group that identifies as Nazis, called the Adam Waffen Division. And in those messages, there was a young man saying, hey, I was in Charlottesville. I split people's skulls. I assaulted people. And in particular, I assaulted a person named Emily Gorsensky. And that set us off on reporting to figure out, hey, who is this person saying they engaged in these attacks? And let's figure it out.
Yeah, and who is Emily Gorsensky?
Emily Gorsensky is an activist who lived in Charlottesville at the time, and she was with a group of anti-racist students on the night of the Torch March, August 11th. As that march turned into a melee and pure mayhem, she was one of the many people who were attacked by the white supremacists. And in these logs, you have a Nazi saying, hey, I'm the one who attacked Emily Gorsensky, and in fact, I attacked other people.
And did you interviewed Emily Gorsensky? Did she recognize?
That was the thing. You know, I had been in contact with her, and when I came across these messages and I got photos of Vasilius Pistolis and I got video, we went through it together, and she said, absolutely, that is the man who ran into the crowd and launched a flying kick at me. She said, I don't think it hit me. I think it hit someone next to me. He may have punched me, but he definitely was one of the people that instigated the violence that night.
What's interesting is that Vasilius Pistolis could have been jeopardizing his military career by outing himself. Did he identify himself as a Marine in these postings?
In the postings that he made, and these were in a closed private chat by members of the group Adam Waffen, he gave enough hints that you would know that he was in the military. And there were several other people that did the same, who gave hints that they were active duty soldiers, sailors, Marines. So that was a thing that we thought was important. Like, hey, this is a guy who has access to weapons. He has access to the best military training in the world. And he is involved in a neo-Nazi group and attacking people. And the group that he was a member of at the time is not just a neo-Nazi group. They are an avowedly terrorist organization whose goal is to overthrow the government of the United States of America and launch a race war.
So you figured out that Lance Corporal Pistolis was stationed, I guess, in North Carolina, and you reached him, right? What did he say?
At first, he said, I wasn't there. And then I said, but hey, I have photos of you there. I have video of you there. And then he said, hey, it was all just joking. You know, I was joking about attacking Emily Gorsensky. And then I said, but it just doesn't seem like a joke. And his pitch to me at that point was basically like, hey, I'll inform on other members of the movement and help you with your career if you just drop this. Because, you know, you probably don't want to keep working at ProPublica. That's not a very reputable establishment.
What is the Marine Corps' policy on political activity among Marines?
So throughout all branches of the military, being involved in a racial extremist group is banned. You are not allowed to be a member of a white supremacist group. You're not allowed to participate in white supremacist demonstrations. You cannot do that. And this is policy that comes from the DOD at the top, and each branch interprets it slightly differently, but they all have their own regulations. So he was forbidden not only under criminal law from engaging in assaults, he was barred under military policy from being a member of one of these groups and going to these events.
I believe you also spoke to a former Marine who had served in the same unit that Lance Corporal Pistolis did, and had observed and was troubled by his activities and reported them to the Marines, right?
Yeah, so that was one of the crazy things, right? We do the first story on Pistolis, and we say, hey, this guy is an active duty Marine. He appears to have been involved in these assaults and appears to be deeply involved in the white supremacist and neo-Nazi movements. What's going on here? After we did that story, a former Marine named Ed Beck reached us and he said, hey, I've been looking at Pistolis for a long time. And he said, in fact, I contacted the Marine Corps back in October. When I was talking to Beck, this was about 6 months later. And he says, look, they've been sitting on this for 6 months. And we went back to the Marine Corps and we said, did you know about this guy 6 months ago? And we got a bunch of different answers, but the one that I think is the most accurate is that there had been an investigation and that essentially the military investigators had dropped it. And that was pretty surprising to me.
But they eventually did take some action.
After our story ran, they eventually court-martialed Pistolis. They locked him up, or they sentenced him to a term of 30 days of confinement in the brig, and are in the process of ousting him from the service.
Billie Holiday, I sing your blues. Bet your life against me and I swear to God you'll lose it. Motherfuck the cops, we still singing for St. Louis. Motherfuck the cops, we still singing for St. Louis. Motherfuck the cops, we still singing for St. Louis.
St. Louis County Prosecutor Bob McCulloch secured his seventh term in office just 5 days before Michael Brown was shot and killed by a Ferguson police officer in August 2014. As St. Louis Public Radio's Rachel Lippman reports, that shooting and the push for criminal justice reform it generated are shaping the Democratic primary between McCulloch and his challenger, Wesley Bell.
Bell was elected to the Ferguson City Council in April 2015. He says campaigning in the aftermath of Brown's death made him even more aware of the power the prosecutor has in the justice system.
I think when we look at what our region has gone through, and we've gone through a lot in the last few years, I think that there is no bigger impact that can be made than in the county prosecutor's office. The prosecutor can decide not to charge, to charge, give a more severe charge.
Bell wants to use that power to make major changes to how St. Louis County prosecutes crimes. He's pledged never to seek the death penalty. He agrees with calls to completely eliminate cash bail. And he wants to expand the county's use of diversion programs like drug courts.
What this office has not done is commit to these kind of programs. So there's a drug treatment program in St. Louis County currently, and There's only about 75 people in it.
McCullough disputes Bell's characterization.
We keep it around that number in order to be able to effectively provide services. We could double it tomorrow. That would be easy. But then each one of them would get half of what they're getting now, which is not effective, and we're doing nobody any good at all.
Drug courts are meant for those with serious addictions, McCullough says. Many other defendants get treatment while on probation and parole. He is also proud of helping start the county's Veterans Court.
And the good news is we're able to partner with the VA, and the VA provides all of the treatment services. And so we can get as many in there as we can. And that has been also a very successful program.
McCullough's ads tout his long tenure as prosecutor. He calls Bell's lack of criminal experience dangerous.
My new prosecutors all start off doing what a municipal prosecutor does. They're certainly not going to be put in positions of now you're a supervisor because you've done a traffic docket.
Bell paints himself as a proven reformer. He highlights his role in negotiating a settlement to the federal civil rights lawsuit against Ferguson. And he also points to the work he did in helping establish the North County Police Cooperative, which patrols six small cities.
For cities, particularly economically challenged communities that they police, to see the trust that has been building and the relationships that have been building with that law enforcement department, it's been great.
In order to build that same type of trust with prosecutors, Bell plans to open satellite offices across the county. The race has attracted national attention. Color of Change PAC and the ACLU have combined to spend about $200,000 on ads and field organizing, mostly to Bell's benefit. McCullough says the outside groups are ignoring the changes he's made.
I think they've adopted the philosophy that and some of their funders that, hey, anybody who's been there a long time is the problem, and therefore, you know, we're opposed to them, no matter what they're doing, and we don't even bother finding out what they're doing.
Even with the outside assistance for Bell, McCullough holds a significant fundraising advantage. He's also gotten money and endorsements from most of the local labor groups, which may prove critical, with so-called right to work also on the ballot. Whoever wins the August primary is all but guaranteed a win in November. No other candidate has filed for the office. I'm Rachel Lipman, St. Louis Public Radio.
That grace founded on two-thirds a person. Rapings and beatings and suffering and worsens. Black human packages tied up in strings. Black rage can come from all these kinds of things. Black race founded on blatant denial, discrete economics, subsistence survival, deafening silence and social control. Black race is founded on wounds in the soul. When the dogs bite, when the bees sting, when I'm feeling sad, I simply remember all these kinds of things, and then I don't feel so bad.
You took my son away from me. You know how hard it was for me to get him to stay in school and graduate?
You know the facts. Michael Brown was 18 years old when Ferguson police shot and killed him. The teenager's death gave birth to the Black Lives Matter movement, which demands Americans stop government-sanctioned violence against black people. Now, this is one of the most significant events in recent U.S. history. It really defines a generation of all Americans, black, white, Hispanic, Asian. But you probably only had one view of this story. From the outside, looking in, through the lens of national media, you know, quick TV reports and newspaper articles. And this is significant because for some people, what happened in 2014 was a riot, whereas for others, it was an uprising. Most people just don't know the real story, the view from the eyes of people who were there marching, sweating, dodging rubber bullets. Sabaya Folayan is changing that. She wrote and directed Whose Streets. Her film premieres tonight on PBS at 10. It aims to show a different perspective on what happened in Ferguson, a different view of the start of the Black Lives Matter movement. Sabaya is here She's really trying to just make sure the voices of people who were on the ground yelling enough is enough, that their voice is still being heard. Welcome.
Thank you so much.
So what steps did you take to make sure your documentary was actually different from all the other accounts of what happened in Ferguson?
Yeah, one of the first things that I did when I touched down in Ferguson with my director of cinematography, Lucas Alvarado Farrar, is we looked for a collaborator who was born and raised in that community. And that's how we met Damon Davis, my co-director, very well-respected visual artist, very well-known in the community and already active in organizing. Together, we decided to tell a story that was going to be a people's history, that was going to honor and reflect the people on the ground with dignity and, you know, really be a celebration of what St. Louis is.
Saba, you used a certain technique that's really critical that enables your documentary to have really a unique perspective. What was the technique you used in terms of footage?
Well, we gathered footage from many, many different sources. We got there about a month after Mike Brown was killed, and we began shooting from that point on. But everything you see before that is gathered from live streamers, people on social media, as well as local journalists. And we felt like we could sort of replicate what people were seeing on the ground by using the media that they were producing at that time. The same thing goes for the tweets that you see used throughout the film. So our goal was to really create a piece that would be sort of a time capsule for what this moment felt like if you were standing in the middle of it.
What percentage of the footage do you think is actually shot by the protesters versus what you shot when you arrived?
That's hard to say because we shot hundreds of hours of footage that, you know, didn't make the cut. But I think I would say probably about 20% of it, probably a third of what you see in the first, like, half of the movie is collected. And then the rest of it really relies on the things that we filmed ourselves.
So why did you go to Ferguson in the first place? I mean, you're bright, you had a nice life, Ivy League educated, young woman of color. Why take yourself from that point of privilege and security to do this, to go right into what many people thought was a mad scene, to put yourself in danger?
Well, it was a bit personal and a bit professional. I was working in the nonprofit sector, and I found myself frustrated because I felt like my ideas didn't really have the room to be expressed from the confines of a sort of entry-level nonprofit job, and I wanted to find a way to work on my own. My background had been pre-med, and I had been studying trauma. So I wanted to go actually do a public health study to see the trauma that would play out in this community as a result of this conflict. And when we got there, it was just clear that you couldn't do that kind of clinical research, or I couldn't, in those circumstances. And that's how we organically started to film and ask questions.
And yet you're trained to look at those things. Were there any insights that your training in trauma actually picked up?
Well, it was really exactly what I expected. People, I think, who lived through the worst of that are still experiencing symptoms of PTSD, have suffered the mental health impacts of this situation, and it's something that my co-director and I are trying to work within the community to try to provide some resources and help folks with healing. But also on a longer scale, I think it's worth observing what's going to play out. How are the relationships in this community going to shift, both in the police and in civilians? What are the long-term impacts of this? Because the level of conflict, the level of artillery, the level of chemical weapons, you don't inflict that on a citizen population and expect there not to be long-term ramifications.
You spoke with so many people. You didn't plan to stay there as long as you did. Is that right?
No, not necessarily. The first time we went, we were doing sort of voting drives and food drives and trying to do community service and help and see what we could learn. But after the first interview that we got, we realized that there was an untold story here, that people were not being taken seriously, that with all the resources that were being poured into covering this, no one was really stopping to get the full picture. A lot of folks talk about objectivity, but it seemed like to us, the objective side was taking at face value public officials and police departments who were essentially investigating themselves.
Who were essentially investigating themselves, and you take a different approach. What were you most surprised by?
I was most surprised, honestly, by the lack of critical engagement on behalf of the media. And I'll give an example. It was the day of Ferguson, October, and I was speaking to the police chief. I had sort of inserted myself into the gaggle of press, and I was asking him...
The gaggle.
give me journalists. But I was asking him, you know, about something that had happened the night before when police had been banging their batons against their shields in this rhythmic way at this protest. And, you know, it was intimidating for the protesters there. So he was saying how all the police wanted was for everyone to be safe and express themselves. And I asked what was the meaning of that tactic. And his response was that the police just wanted to have their voices heard, too. And so I wondered, what was the message that police were trying to send? And he begins to spin his answer and avoid really responding to that question. And before I could sort of get an answer from him, another reporter interjected and asked, do you think these protests are going to affect the baseball game? And
the baseball game.
Right. And it was this kind of complacency and this kind of willingness to sort of let these people in positions of power off the hook with these very vague sort of non-responses that I found extremely frustrating.
You were raised in South Central Los Angeles, and I remember back in the day it was sort of a very, very tough place. Times are changing now. Did you ever have run-ins with the police yourself?
Not personally. I was sort of that kid that wasn't really allowed to go outside too much, although I was raised in the hood on 41st and Figueroa. My mom had a sort of different vision for me, and she did really intentionally shelter me from a lot of that. But, you know, everyone who I've ever dated has been stopped, has been bullied, has been beaten up. It's such a commonplace story that I think about, if I ever were to want to start a family, like, how could I even responsibly do that in this country?
Your mother took such pains to insulate you, to protect you, to keep you inside. And there you go. You went right into to this. But you've also been, interviewing folks in Rikers Island as well. How does that research inform what you do today?
That has really been foundational to my understanding, because what I realized speaking to folks at Rikers, the one moment forever sticks in my head. I was talking to a 17-year-old kid, and I'm trying to talk him through doing this goal-setting worksheet. And he looks at me and he says, I'm 17, and I'm looking at 15 and a half years in prison. How am I supposed to set goals? And I couldn't answer that question. I couldn't tell this child how he was supposed to conceive of, you know, spending almost as long as he'd been alive, incarcerated, and, you know, the things that had happened to him in his life as a child, as a vulnerable person, were so unjust and so unfair. And there had been no kind of justice for him. Nothing restorative had happened. No one had come to punish the people who had done him wrong. But yet here I was, supposedly trying to convince this kid that he needed to accept and take responsibility for his actions and try to envision a life, you know, sort of in a cage for as long as he'd been on this earth already. It just fundamentally did not sit right with me, and it really struck me in that moment how deeply our society has failed its children and how these problems just continue to multiply and grow. And how sort of arbitrarily we decide that, okay, this is justice and this is right and this is wrong. It's not inclusive. It doesn't take into account history. It doesn't take into account trauma. And so now I move much more holistically, and I'm always trying to think about how can we conceive of a future that is really responsive to people's lived experiences.
Does that story still haunt you, Saba?
Absolutely. Absolutely. As long as children are in cages in this country, as long as we see that as a solution, I'm not going to be able to rest. And I feel like it's my responsibility to use whatever resources are at my disposal to try to come up with something different.
Do you think your documentary can help convince people about these concerns to view them as legitimate?
I think, and I hope, that for Black folks and for people who are oppressed and for people who understand how it feels when you are supposed to be a citizen, but there is no higher power, no justice department, no police department, no mayor's office, no one to stand on your behalf, and you're left with no choice to stand for yourself and your community as a civilian. I hope that those people see that this is legitimate, that what they're experiencing is real, that the people who represent this movement are not just looters, not just rioters, not crazy people, just mad. They're mothers and fathers and teachers and nurses and very, very smart people and people with a lot at stake who are making sacrifices for all of our future.
And they're not just Black.
No, they're not.
I mean, that's sort of a popular misconception, but when you go there on the ground and you see the diversity of people who are out there yelling, chanting, Black Lives Matter, it makes you think that this is much deeper than just the protection of Black lives, which is critical, but It's a symbolic of something greater. What is that greater?
Wow! Hey, yo, drama, hold up, sir. Hold on. Stop the motherfucking record.
All right.
I want you to Pondy replay, drama. Pondy replay.
Let's give him one more chance, man. Run that shit the fuck back.
And they're not just black.
No, they're not.
I mean, that's sort of a popular misconception, but when you go there on the ground and you see the diversity of people who are out there yelling, chanting, Black Lives Matter, it makes you think that this is much deeper than just the protection of black lives, which is critical, but it's a symbolic of something greater. What is that greater?
Absolutely. This is about the evolution of humanity. This is about reconstructing the way that we define what is a valuable person. The way that we define what is peace, what is order, what is law, what is right, what is wrong, all of that has been based up to this point on a racial hierarchy. And throughout the world, anywhere you go, dark-skinned people are suffering the worst. And so this is not about civil rights. It's not about voting. It's not about, you know, how you are engaging necessarily in the political process. This is about fundamentally reimagining the way that we conceive of ourselves and the way that we conceive of power.
So, but what new forms of community have formed in Ferguson since that day? I understand that your documentary really looks into that as well.
Absolutely. People have sort of organized into cadres, different people having different focuses and you know, different sort of affinities, but they continue to be very active in local politics. People continue to be very active in sort of creating alternative solutions, being their own solutions. The Books and Breakfast program has been really popular, something adopted from the Panthers. People are just active in this network that was built. You know, there's this group of people there now that really shares this permanent bond. And one thing that I'll add, too, is that this moment was such a spark globally that everywhere I've been with this film, across the United States and abroad, and, you know, dozens of different countries, people were connected by this moment. People were woken up by this moment. And that's a network and an intangible sort of social connection that is going to continue to have ripple effects.
Now, what about Cop Watch? I mean, I understand that people are taking things into their own hands. That can be threatening to established government, to local government. How do you negotiate that?
I mean, people have had their backs pushed up against the wall. And at this point, if an established government is threatened by someone, you know, exercising their basic rights, is threatened by being watched as they do their job, I think that raises much more of a question of what is the established government going to do to improve their relationship with citizens.
So to be clear, when we talk about Cop Watch, we're talking about a movement there where people are recording the police officers as they're going about their jobs. Is that right?
Right. Correct. And my thinking is that if you are truly protecting and serving, then you should be proud and comfortable to be filmed doing your job in service of the community.
So, as you know, your film is going to debut tonight on PBS. What do you want people to take away? What is the angle that we have not seen anywhere else?
There are several things. The first is just I want people to be reminded of the beauty and the dignity with which black people do and have always upheld the values that this country claims and has not yet stepped into. I also want people to understand the level of artillery that local governments are wielding against civilians is really a threat to the concept of democracy. When protest can be met with that much weaponry, we have moved past, you know, the sort of ideal of free speech and what America means into something that is very, very repressive and very, very similar to the types of things that we're judgmental about when we see them taking place in other countries.
We have to wrap up this interview, but you are one of these latchkey kids who grows up, and there are a lot of kids like you. Would you encourage them to get involved, given the amount of fear that's out there?
Yeah, I absolutely do. I think fear, it's a protection, but it also can be a signal that you're going towards growth. We naturally fear change as a survival mechanism, but you do things anyway. You carry the fear with you and you do it anyway. And I hope that anyone who sees this movie and is feeling like, you know, what do they need to do? Just apply your skills to the problem.
Thank you so much for joining us today. You've been listening to Saba Folayan talk about her documentary, Whose Streets? It airs tonight at 10 on PBS POV and POV.org.
Black race founded, fed us self-hatred, lies and abuse. While we waited and waited, spiritual treason, this grid and its cages. Black rage is founded on these kinds of things. Black rage is founded on training and training, threatening your freedom, stop your complaining, poisoning your water while they say it's raining. Mad for complaining, complaining. Progress, such human contortion. Black rage is founded on these kinds of things.
It has been 6 years since Trayvon Martin was shot and killed while coming back from a trip to a convenience store in Sanford, Florida. Martin was 17 years old and unarmed. The shooter was a 28-year-old neighborhood watch volunteer named George Zimmerman. Martin's death and Zimmerman's eventual acquittal became national news.
Suddenly, everybody knew who Trayvon Martin was.
Trayvon Martin.
It was like an explosion.
That's a clip from a new documentary series called Rest in Power, the Trayvon Martin story. The series looks back on Zimmerman's trial and explains why Martin's death is relevant today. Karen Grigsby-Bates from our Code Switch team has more.
Rest in Power begins with a great deal of national sympathy for young Trayvon Martin. Then President Barack Obama held a press conference and uttered these words.
You know, if I had a son, he'd look like Trayvon.
Damn you, Obama.
Director Julia Willoughby Nason.
Identifying race, you know, in a compassionate way is just not done in this country. And I think Obama was very compassionate and straightforward in saying that that Trayvon could have looked like him.
But, says series co-director Jenner First, that simple observation immediately alienated many white Americans.
The second that Obama said that Trayvon could have been his son, it became a window for right-wing commentators to start evolving their coverage.
Like Bill O'Reilly, then the star host of Fox News.
Zimmerman is not being treated fairly.
Now George Zimmerman was the victim of a president who was overreaching.
Tracy Martin, Trayvon's father, told me last week he felt the change immediately.
Trayvon was the victim in this case, and so they tried to make him be the villain in this case.
Now it wasn't George Zimmerman who was on trial, but Trayvon and his family and friends. He was criticized for skipping school and getting suspended for writing on a locker. A forensic report revealed he had marijuana in his system the night he was killed. In a jury selection scene from the 2013 trial, one potential juror seemed to think poor parenting is what led ultimately to Trayvon's death in her town.
Being a single parent with two boys of my own, I don't want to judge, but I just want to say that this could have been prevented if he had not been up here.
The televised cross-examination of Rachel Gentel, the young woman who was the last person to talk to Trayvon, was brutal, and it doesn't get any easier when the series replays it. Gentel, a reluctant witness for the prosecution, came across as a surly 19-year-old who answered the defense's goading questions in mangled short sentences. Trayvon's mother, Sabrina Fulton, still resents how Gentel was treated.
I just felt that she was somebody's daughter, she was somebody's sister, she was, you know, somebody's friend, and she deserved that respect.
One defense lawyer questioned Gentel's literacy on the stand and made an oblique, snide reference to her weight. Meanwhile, support was building for George Zimmerman. He was adopted by white nationalists and the alt-right as a martyr who'd been sacrificed to politically correct liberals. He didn't testify on his own behalf, but a police interview used in the series gives his explanation of events. In it, Zimmerman, who didn't participate in this series, says he was ambushed by Trayvon Martin.
And he said, "What the problem, homie?" And I say, "Hey, man, I don't have a problem." And he goes, "No, now you have a problem." And he punched me in the nose.
Later, police footage shows Zimmerman with bandages on his nose and head as he shows police where the fight occurred. Directors Nason and First made Florida's Stand Your Ground law, the ability to shoot and kill in self-defense, a major character in this series. They say the NRA has successfully used white anxiety about perceived black violence to grow and keep its membership for years. Here they show NRA CEO Wayne LaPierre taunting the media at a convention.
Go ahead, write about our paranoia.
But there is no greater freedom than the right to protect our families with all the rifles, shotguns, and handguns we want.
Stand Your Ground was not cited specifically by George Zimmerman's lawyers, but Jenner First says that doesn't mean it wasn't there.
There's a common misconception that Stand Your Ground was not involved in this case, and I think that that is a really dangerous thing.
In fact, although the defense did not lean on Stand Your Ground, it was included in the judge's final instructions to the jury. Most of us remember how this ended. George Zimmerman was acquitted. The six-person jury said the state had not adequately proved its case for second-degree murder. Although she was bitterly disappointed, Sabrina Fulton told me she was heartened to see the diversity of people who came out to protest her son's death and to demand justice for him.
We didn't get into this situation with just African-Americans, and we're not going to get out of this situation with just African-Americans. And I think all races see that it's not necessarily about civil rights, but it's about human rights.
One of her child's favorite articles of clothing took on an importance none of them could have guessed. On camera, activist Angela Davis explains.
Trayvon's hoodie became a symbol and helped create the sense of community and the sense of a community in struggle.
The hoodie was worn by street demonstrators, by a legislator on the floor of the U.S. Congress, and by professional athletes like LeBron James, silent indicators of common support. Tracy Martin says his son's death became a rallying point, just as another black boy's murder did in 1955.
Back in the Emmett Till days, that was our call to action. And so 2012, Trayvon Benjamin Martin became our call to action.
The abduction, torture, and ultimate murder of 14-year-old Emmett Till in Money, Mississippi was a catalyst for the modern civil rights movement. Sabrina Fulton says the growth of Black Lives Matter after Trayvon's death is often countered with pushback that all lives matter. Why only black lives? She has a response.
It's not taken away from anybody else's life. It's just putting emphasis on black lives because black lives seem to be so disposable.
Tracy Martin says when Trayvon first died, he and Sabrina thought their case was an isolated one. But as time has passed and as so many other black males have been killed, Tamir Rice, Michael Brown, Philando Castile, Alton Sterling, and on, he understands there is a connection. He and Sabrina have established a foundation in Trayvon's name to provide emotional and financial support to families who have lost a child to gun violence. Tracy Martin.
Even though we know we can't save our son, we want to save someone else's son or daughter.
Rest in Power, the Trayvon Martin story, airs in 6 episodes, beginning tonight on the Paramount Network. Karen Grigsby-Bates, NPR News.
Well, that just sounds like a heap of entertaining summer fun. Context of white supremacy. They said 6 episodes. Man. Compensatory call-in if you have comments, questions, counter-racist suggestions. The number to dial, 641-715-3640. The code, 564-943 pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. I am Gus T. Renegade, your host. This is The Cows, Saturday, August 4th. 2018, so I have been told. The number again for the compensatory call-in, 641-715-3640. The code, 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Before I get to anything, that word community, they said Angela Davis, the Angela Davis, in the documentary film apparently has a portion where she says the hoodie that became a community of support. Now, she victim of white supremacy, she gets VGQ. She said what she said. However, I do point out pretty consistently, as have many others, you cannot have a community if you are subject to racism. I have no idea, and perhaps she does have a PhD. I think it is Dr. Angela Davis. Perhaps she could explain what she means when she says community, because maybe she has a different framework for what that term means. But I would definitely like to know how putting on a garment of clothing, how that forms a community, especially since I saw suspected race soldiers wearing hoodies when that whole the murder of Trayvon Martin became a spectacle for years and continues, in my opinion. I remember suspected race soldiers wearing hoodies. I remember dogs wearing hoodies, selfies of people and dogs together wearing hoodies, apparently all in solidarity with Trayvon Martin. I don't know if the dog is a part of the community. No idea, but words are very important, especially that word community, because it gets used so frequently. And it seems like, if anything, this is a community under siege. You can't have a community if you are under siege and totally helpless to do anything about it. And these problems continuing to happen, as they said, for years would indicate you have a group helpless to do anything about this so far. That is not a community, just following logic. Things to get to before we get to callers. We are listener-supported, counter-racist radio. Invest if you think the program is constructive. racism-notes.blogspot.com. racism-notes.blogspot.com. PayPal button is in the top right corner. Thank you so much. Enormous gratitude to all the folks who have invested nearly a decade. If you're not into PayPal, you can drop me an email and we can get you a physical mailing address. But all of the support is immensely appreciated. It has certainly helped keep us on the air for nearly a decade. You can also support at my wish list. It's listed as Gus T. Renegade at Amazon.com. It is also posted on my blog directly under the PayPal button. Much obliged to all the folks who have nabbed an item or two from the Amazon list as well. The support is immensely appreciated, never taken for granted. Other topics to get to before we get to the callers. The segment that was talking about affirmative action, what they call affirmative action at Harvard University, and how that relates to Asian, what so-called Asian students being admitted. Very interesting for the terms that were being used. They had the term lopping, they had the term tipping, and they gave definitions for what those terms mean. And lopping, they said at the end, when maybe they have too many folks, that lopping might be used to get rid of some people, and racism might be a factor there. And then tipping, giving people an advantage, maybe we will lean in your favor to accepting you to this prestigious institution. Tipping, racism factored in there. And then Gus T, peak word, a word I consistently pay attention to and emphasize, discretion. They have discretion about who's going to be admitted, racism factoring in there as well. The passing of the former mayor of Oakland, Ron Dellums, they talked about his counter-racist activities, fighting against white supremacy in South Africa. Even former president, suspected racist Bill Clinton, had to get his thoughts in on his passing as well. He is so refined, so skilled at seeming as though he is a really concerned white man, and any black person who has dedicated themselves to racism, white supremacy, I am going to be there. He was there at the funeral for Coretta Scott King. He gave the eulogy for the passing of Muhammad Ali. Of course, he has to tweet in his response for the passing of Ron Dellums. Slick Willie. Next, I will interrupt. I cannot get through a session without talking about what happened at yoga class, or this actually was yoga teacher training. I will try to be brief. I exit. We do the book club yesterday, Bara Kuhn, Zora Neale Hurston. Almost done. We're halfway through the book already. Very short. So we do the book club yesterday. Immediately exit, go to teacher training. We're watching a documentary film on a non-white yoga practitioner. Very well known. Read a great autobiography. We're watching this documentary on this non-white male, Swami Yogananda. This non-white male comes from India to the United States, 20th century. This is all in a documentary film. I think it's on Netflix. You can watch this. He comes over, just telling us the story, how he got involved in yoga, about his life, what it was like for him growing up in India. He comes to the U.S. He's trying to spread his yoga practice. He starts off in New York. He moves out to California and is building up his practice. This is in the like 1920s, right after World War I. He's picking up followers and is doing pretty well. He decides to come to what they call the Chocolate City. And things go downhill from there. White supremacy racism dominates the documentary from this point to the point where I thought, wow, I could have just continued the broadcast from the yoga teacher training and we would have been talking about the same topic in detail. He does go to Washington, D.C., Swami Yogananda. He goes there. And this is a non-white male, no passing. He's dark, a lot of melanin. He goes to Washington, D.C. He's going to do his lecture. It's thousands of people. I think more than 5,000 people. He's drawing huge crowds. He's going to give his lecture, the nation's capital. He says, oh, sure, black people can come to the meeting, no problem. Uh-oh, major problem. The whites, what? Oh, absolutely not. The Negroes are not going to learn any yoga in here. Yogananda says, oh, no, I am not going to practice racism. If black people want to learn yoga in D.C., absolutely, they are welcome. In fact, he starts a school for black people to study and learn yoga in D.C. I'm stunned. I'd never heard of any of this information. Was wishing Dr. Welsing was still with us so I could ask. She was really into studying local Washington, D.C. She spent so many decades there. Anyway, from this point, oh, man. Things, he starts to get a lot of trouble, a lot of problems from the time he goes to D.C. and insists that black people can participate in his lectures and learn yoga. Go back to California. Uh-oh, I can don't even want to get my sound effects. I'll be lazy with it. Goes back to California. Uh-oh, now he's got some of his dark melanated students doing private yoga lessons for white women. Insert cowbell, even more problems. What are we letting these dark foreigners in here to do this anyway? They're coming after our white women and we're done with all of this. So he gets all these problems and ends up having to close down his school and major problem directly related to white supremacy racism. So he leaves. He eventually goes back to India. He's teaching yoga, done with the United States. He doesn't want to teach anymore. Interruption number two, white supremacy racism. Who do they show marching down the street? None other than Heil Hitler. The rise of Nazi Germany. He sees this from India like, oh my gosh, I can't just sit here and do nothing. I've got to get out, try to practice. People need this. Something's got to be done. I can't just sit here and do this. So he goes out. He's practicing. He comes back to the States. He still continues to teach non-white people. They relate this to what's happening with what they call the civil rights movement and Dr. King and all that. Amazing that all this popped out in the yoga class directly talking about white supremacy, and I did not even bring it up. I'm told this film is on Netflix. Not that you need to watch it, but we did have a hefty chunk of class directly relating to white supremacy while learning about yoga as well. Next comment. 10 years, context of white supremacy. Our 10-year anniversary will be February of this year, if we make it that far. February of 2019, excuse me. Way back in May of 2009, A.C. Thompson of ProPublica was a guest on this program. We talked about his extraordinarily important work on white terrorism in New Orleans, Louisiana, after Hurricane Katrina in 2005. His report came out, I believe, in either 2008, 2009. He did a lot of interviews in addition to The Cows. His essay was in The Nation, where he talked about this. He was on another PBS documentary called Law and Disorder, which is phenomenal. You should check it out. Goes into a lot of detail about white enforcement officers killing black people after Hurricane Katrina who were not looters, who were just black people trying to get to safety and were shot and killed. And white citizens, race soldiers, with or without a badge, killing black people, and even whites bragging about coming. They didn't even live in the New Orleans area. Some of them didn't even live in the state of Louisiana, flocked just for the opportunity to kill black people. That's A.C. Thompson. I know him well. 10 years of The Cows. Now, he did the report on Charlottesville. I'm very suspicious about all of that because my general thought with that, number one, is that somehow this is going to get to Heather Heyer and this white woman. Oh, my goodness. She died. I can't believe it. White victimhood. That's generally where I feel most of those reports on what happened in Charlottesville last year. That's where they're going to go. It's not going to be accurate information about racism, white supremacy. And we might even have some racial focal pointing, meaning making it seem that this group of whites with the torches out who killed this white woman, they are the racists, and that the whites who were combating them in the streets and Heather Heyer, they're not racist. They do a really good job. That's why I'm very suspicious about any of these reports. I was especially suspicious because A.C. Thompson is a veteran journalist. He said, I've been reporting on cops for 20 years. There's no way, in my view, you can give this report as A.C. Thompson and not say, well, hey, I have done a lot of reporting about white terrorism, correct use of language, because I didn't hear the word terrorism used in that report about what happened in Charlottesville, correct use of language, and I've seen mobs of white terrorists for years. They were doing this in New Orleans, linking so that this is not something that's arbitrary, and this is not even just something that was happening in response to the 2016 election. This is just white behavior over a long period of time, and I have to extend that because he said what surprised him most was that the police in Charlottesville, suspected race soldiers, their plan, it seems, was we're not going to intervene. We'll just let them duke it out in the streets. We'll call it mutual combat and let it ride. That seems to be what the plan, according to what he said in the report. I'm paraphrasing. I've seen that pattern before from suspected race soldier enforcement officials where they just say, we're not going to intervene. We're not going to protect and serve. If there happen to be racists here and there happen to be niggers or nigger lovers and the racists and nigger lovers and niggers, if they want to fight or the racists just decide that they want to maul and terrorize the niggers, we'll just sit back. We'll wait. And then maybe after 5 or 10 minutes, we'll break it up and send everyone on their way. That used to be widely practiced during what they call the civil rights movement. Again, in fact, they got some of that documented footage, what they call the freedom rides. That was the exact plan. And if you're a 20-year journalist, you should know that information. That should be linked again so that if this gets presented in full context, this is continuity of white barbarism, continuity of white terrorism, where they're just enacting the same terroristic behaviors, not isolated incidents, and not even really something that should be that's surprising. Again, we just go back to 2005, police conduct there. Next, and I would still encourage folks to go back and hear that interview with A.C. Thompson because he had a lot of important information. Hurricane Katrina, some of our signature work here at The Contact, or some of our most important work, I think, that reveals a lot of truth about what it means to be white, what racism is, how it works. I have said, major point of emphasis for Gus T on this program, I've said for years, this is like a new genre, Black Death. We'll do documentaries, and I think Red in Nevada, she was talking yesterday about authenticity, presenting projects that are focused on niggers and saying, oh, we want it to be authentic. We want, you know, actual bullet holes and the way that the niggers really talk. I am totally repulsed with all of the documentaries. I don't care who does them. If it's a non-white person, I don't care if it's an entertainer. I have no concern with any of that. All of these films focused on black people, I feel it just reinforces black death. It's necrophilia. That is a key term I've invoked on this program for almost a decade. It is the essence of necrophilia and just black, the consumption of black death. And it seems in this case, especially black male death, although it could be black males, black females. Just in this instance, that's what we got. Trayvon Martin, Michael Brown Jr. There are more of these that comes. I think they just said that there's supposed to be a documentary coming out about a more recent shooting victim. I've written about this before. I think this is a major act of white supremacy. I think this has a huge impact on black mental health. You take your summer days, 6 parts, they said, for Trayvon Martin to go back and review all of that footage. These are not incidents, in my view, that people are ignorant about. This is pretty what they call recent history. You're talking about events that happened in 2012, 2013 with Trayvon Martin, with Michael Brown Jr., 2014. This is not stuff that happened 10, 20, 50 years ago. Most people watch these events intensely, regardless of what their perspective is. Intensely. This was coverage that you almost could not avoid. I know Gus T was attempting mightily to avoid coverage of Trayvon Martin. And even I remember Rachel Gentile, her treatment by the defense. I remember the white prosecutor taking selfies eating ice cream after they had badgered her on the witness stand the summer of 2013 with the fiasco Michael Brown Jr. and Ferguson, or standard operating procedure of white terrorism. I remember all of that in vivid detail. 4.5 hours left the body in the street. I remember the names. Alderman Freeman, and it's not just me. I suspect a whole lot of people. They just sat and watched this on Twitter all August long for 2014. Remember Alderman Freeman? All these people, remember Bob McCullough? They're still talking about this. National attention. People are not ignorant about these events. They are very informed. I don't even think a lot of young people are very ignorant about these events. They remember this stuff in tremendous detail. I think all this does is serve to reinforce black death. That's what we're going to keep the focus on. That's how we'll get to know people, through black people dying. Even with the Ferguson incident especially, that was when people bragged about that. That was the feeling that I got when people talk about the March on Washington, that it took on a tone not of protest, but of something almost like you're at an event of some sort. Like, oh, were you there? I was at the march. Were you there? That was the very same feeling that I had about what happened in Ferguson. Were you there? I was there. Look on my social media feed. I got all of my pictures. That's how individuals like Crystal Tyler came to the attention of Cow's listeners. She was in Ferguson promoting her tacky book with her tragic arrangement situation, black husband, non-white daughter in tow in Ferguson. It was lots of that sort of thing going on at the time period. And again, I don't think any of that is working against racism, white supremacy. In fact, I could stop all my commentary with these documentaries, 6 parts, 8 parts, 20 parts. They just had the one on Kalief Browder not that long ago. Definition of racism, white supremacy. That's what I said before. I'll say that one again. If you saw the documentary on Trayvon Martin, I didn't see that. Have no intention of seeing it. The documentary on Michael Brown Jr., ditto. Definition of racism, white supremacy. Did anybody see those films? And was there a definition of racism, white supremacy? If the definition was there, was it accurate? And when I say was it accurate, it doesn't even have to be my definition. It wouldn't even have to be Dr. Welsing's definition, but a definition that you could say that makes logical sense in a system of white supremacy, the definition that they used. That would be my question. I probably will in a wager a hefty sum. They did not have a definition of racism, white supremacy, and that would be a major assessment of how constructive do I think these projects are? If you're not giving out an accurate definition of racism, white supremacy, which in my view explains why these killings happened, what are we doing? What is our aim for these projects if not just reveling in consuming black carcasses? With a lot of that, literally, metaphorically, there is a lot of that in the system of racism, white supremacy. That's what I think these projects are. And I'll make sure that I get it stated openly. Yes, this is Gus T saying, I have no interest in a documentary on Trayvon Martin, Michael Brown Jr., or any other black victims of racism, white supremacy. No, I am not interested in watching any of that or Marvel's Black Panther. Get out either. You can add those on the list as well. White supremacist cinema, all of it. Next. The last thing I will get in, I did think it was very important, the gendered violence. Dr. Tommy Curry, the term black misandry, specific violence, that's what the audio segments, at least to me, that's what's conveyed. When Saba Folavan, I think that's how you say her name, I may have mispronounced it, but she is the black female credited with producing the documentary on Trayvon Martin, 6 parts, my goodness. But she said, the interviewer asked her if she had been stopped. She said she grew up in L.A., California, if she had been stopped or had any incidents with enforcement officials. And she said no. She said her parents kind of shielded her, mom specifically, tried to shield her as best she could from that sort of thing. But she said I put that in all capital letters. She said every person she has dated has had problems, been beat up, stopped, harassed, mauled, whatever it is, by enforcement officers. Now, she didn't state that she was, quote unquote, gay, LGBTI, intersex, whatever it is. So excuse me if I'm engaging in what they call heteronormativity. I'm going to suspect that the people she was dating were males, not females. If that was the case, and if anyone can get information that I'm in error, let Gus T know. But until then, I'm going to make the suspicion that the people she was dating were males. And then all of these reports are about black males who've been mauled and killed, gendered violence. I think that should be stated specifically. Frequently, I think that gets left out if we're talking about racism, white supremacy, or if we're talking about what they call sexism. It does not get applied to, wow, maybe some of this is really amped up against black males. That does not get talked about or left out completely. With that, I will stop there. Metaphors, I guess, make sure I get that in. Metaphors, there were a lot of metaphors that were used in the audio clips. There frequently are. And they were talking about Ferguson. They were saying black people were taking justice into their own hands. They were saying that the black people were up against the wall. The putting on a hoodie and making you community, in my view, that is a metaphor too. This broadcast specifically, I ask if we could not use metaphors. I really think we should make an effort to be as precise, accurate, correct as we can with our words, the way we articulate racism, white supremacy, frequently with the metaphors, analogies, similes. A lot of times we are making comparisons that are simply adding to confusion. Racists, they do this a lot deliberately. That's a part of how they practice deception, white supremacy. Victims, we are still learning. Gus T. Renegade, especially. As such, there are times when we do not have logic. We'll substitute a metaphor or a comparison and hope that that conveys what we're trying to say. And often it just produces more confusion. If we could be direct, explicit with what we're trying to say, that would be super appreciated. I will prompt about metaphors. If you could take 5 minutes to share your commentary, that would be grand. Make sure everyone has at least one opportunity to speak. If you need additional time, make sure everyone has spoken once. And then if you have a question or comment to get in. Again, if you could use your mute button, I would be grateful. If you know you're in a noisy environment, people are talking, or if there's a television, radio, or something on, just use your mute button. When you're ready to talk, try to get to a quiet area, unmute your line, and then once you're done, you can mute your line again. Just helps to preserve the audio quality of the program, and people do not have to try to compete with unnecessary noise disrupting the broadcast. Number again, 641-715-3640, the code 564-943. Pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Final comment I forgot. For people who expressed interest in making a trip to Gus's yoga class that I have to teach later this month, getting more details. I still do not know the exact time of the class, and I asked about that, and they're still trying to work out logistics of how to schedule so many people having to teach a class at the same time. So I do not know the exact time, but I think I had previously said the date was August 19th. It is August 17th, not the Sunday So it's 2 weekends from now. It is not that Sunday. It is that Friday. August 17th is when the class is. And it'll be sometime, I don't know the exact time, but it'll be sometime later in the day. When I say later in the day, like between 5 and 9 p.m. Somewhere in that window, if I had, or somewhere in that time period, if I had to make an estimate, I'd probably say probably somewhere around 6 p.m., but I'm not totally sure. I'll have correct information, hopefully, perhaps tomorrow. I will update as soon as possible, but it is August 17th. We have, that's our whole weekend of finishing the training. So we have lots of things that we have to complete and turn in and do all the way up through that Sunday, but the class is that Friday. So if you are interested, wear your counter-racist t-shirt and come to Gus's class. It would be August 17th, sometime later in the day. I would be appreciative, as I said, trying to balance out the whites that are present and certainly trying to balance out if I have to do any physical adjustments, nothing intimate. If I have to do any adjustments, at least I can pick out some of the non-white possible listeners and do a non-invasive adjustment, and then I won't have to touch any suspected racists. Feel free to give an email if you need additional details. That's it. Folks who dialed in with a hand up, if you have comments, questions, suggestions, line should be open. Proceed. Greetings, Rob in Wisconsin.
Greetings.
Your line has some distortion in it. It's a little difficult to hear you.
Is that better?
Yes, sir.
Okay. So I last talked with you guys on Thursday. Fast forward Friday morning. I was displaced, put out the residence. I was residing in about 7 a.m. in the morning, I want to say. I leave and go to the coffee shop, come back about 8 a.m. I'm denied entry into the residence. I have to call law enforcement to gain entry into the residence to retrieve some of my things. After that, I was escorted back to the coffee shop by law enforcement. And at that point, I didn't have anywhere to go. I called my attempted parent under the system of racism, white supremacy. And I was hung up on. And later on, I received a call stating that and at this point, I'm just riding around on a city bus because I don't got nowhere to go. So I received a call from my attempted parent saying that if I make it there by 8:30, then I can gain entrance into the residence. Gain entrance into the residence. And today, I was informed that my... me residing in the residence probably wouldn't last no longer than 30 days. And connecting it to the clips, the clip where it talked about the 17-year-old facing 15 years, and the female stated that a person black under this system has no one standing up for them. I know that's the metaphor, but yeah, I don't need my line. Thank you.
Wow. I cannot say I'm surprised. I'm really encouraged. Victims of racism working to not be surprised or shocked ever about a non-white person, especially if it's a black person, being mistreated in any kind of way under the system of white supremacy. That's just, I think, code. However, that is horrendous. I'm so sorry that you had to go through that. Rob, that housing displacement, we talked about that. Yes, we talked about that on a regular basis. That is huge in the system. One of the major ways that racists keep us under a total state of chaos and insanity, really, just constantly having us under so much stress about our living arrangement and having it just be chaotic. Even if it's with other non-white people, they're victims too. Just all of that. Oh, and I'm sure, unfortunately, many can relate to those types of difficulties. I'm glad you were able at least to get some sort of temporary assistance. If I could ask a quick question, where you said the enforcement officer, after you were able to retrieve some of your property, escorted you back to the coffee shop. Why did he, or why did the enforcement official, why did they escort you back to the coffee shop?
That's the only place that I could really think of to go to kind of that's the only place I could think of to go and not be outside. I used to work at this particular coffee shop, so I'm familiar with the people. That's the only place that I had to go. And so just the last part that I'll add to the commentary, when I gained entry back into the residence, man, I didn't get things like toiletries for my hygiene. So, you know, I woke up this morning, hadn't showered, you know, and the first thing I did was call law enforcement to gain entry back into the residence to get some of my belongings. And, you know, so I could take care of myself. And when I called law enforcement, the thing that really stood out to me was that the first thing that law enforcement said was that there are laws to protect you against this kind of treatment. You know, she just can't do that to you. Thank you.
Laws generally can be enforced or not enforced arbitrarily. Discretion, I think, is the word that was used before as it relates to black people. I appreciate the additional details. I was still confused as to why the enforcement official, I understand you saying you didn't have any place else to go, so you went to the coffee shop, but I just don't understand why the enforcement official escorted you. Interesting term.
They offered.
Okay. Did you want the escort?
Yes, because my form of transportation right now is the bus.
Okay. Great. I understand. I was thinking it was a different type of situation in terms of the escort, but now I understand.
Got it.
Thank you for the.
Thank you.
I was just confused. And again, I'm very sorry for you having to experience that. That is horrendous, but that is exactly what the system of white supremacy has planned. Racial dislocation. Mr. Fuller talks about that on a regular basis. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up, if you have commentary to share, line should be open.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, this is Ken Steele, and I'm calling from Los Angeles. Just moved into a place here in LA on my own, and I don't know, it's kind of weird. I was hearing the previous caller, and I wanted to ask the previous caller, hey, how much money do you have?
I would just laugh. Like, I have no funds.
because I'm unable to work.
Do you have any, so you don't, you can't work? What's your like working situation?
No, I'm a student, so I've been living off my financial aid. I'm just like within the last week, I'm feeling like I'm able to work. So I have a job opportunity in front of me. I just have to fill out the application, and I've been dragging my feet with that just to give myself, you know, as much time as I can just to try and heal my body before I start to work.
Where do you live? What state?
I'm in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, sir.
Man. My suggestion to you is while you're still in school and, you know, on the short term, you need funds, I would see what I could do about getting more loans. And then from there, I would get myself probably into a different school in a different state, because Milwaukee is probably one of the worst places to be Black. And I know so many people who have been, quote unquote, put out of homes in Chicago and Milwaukee. It's just a very common experience for Black people in those areas. I would recommend, you know, with your next check, probably get yourself a car, something with four doors. And you and many other Black people, Black males especially, we need to learn how to make do with a lot less. And you I don't want to recommend this form of living, but it's something that you can do. You can live out of your car if you have all your stuff registered and your money together, and you can get something for $1,000, maybe $1,500, or even if you're really scraping, you can get something for as low as $500, maybe at a local no license auction, and you can get something that will put you on the road and have you going from point A to point B. And then once you get yourself a car, then you can get yourself a gym membership, and you can kind of trap out the whip. You can live outside of your car for quite some time and be clean. Yes, so if you can survive like that, that can definitely just alleviate this constant, being put out and instability and everything. Because if you can get that straightened out, then you can get, you know, a daily job together. And once you got your job straightened out and some forms of income, be it loans or something, get a place for yourself. If you can afford it, get a place for yourself. It sounds like you're getting on in years. You're not, it doesn't sound like you're a kid. So you're going to need your own space, and being able to control your own space, even if it's a tiny corner and it's, some four walls, minimizing your ability to being, you know, punted out of the space or kicked out of the space. Is just key. But in that interim, in your situation, you do not want to be out on the street, you know, living off out of the bus. Find $500 to $1,500, get yourself a car, get it registered. It's really cheap in your state, and get some, you know, even just papers that say you have insurance. And that's a little bit more stable than what you're doing right now. And it's something that you can get on the path to and, under a month. So, I wish you luck, and it's not the end of the world. You'll make it.
Thank you, sir.
Appreciate that, Mr. Steele. Did want to say one thing quickly. Drag your feet. That is a metaphor. Just wanted to point that out for Black self-respect, because the context of that phrase being used was Robin, Wisconsin. You are not dragging your feet about the employment situation. I believe it was you are taking time to allow your body to heal. That is Black mental health. And I think generally speaking, that's what under normal situation, not the system of white supremacy, a human being would be encouraged. Yes, take your time. You talked about your health situation for a long time. That is extraordinarily important. That's not dragging your feet. That is having maximum regard for your body, your well-being, Black self-respect. Other folks who dialed in, if you have commentary, question, suggestion, line should be open. Proceed.
Bobby Heard.
Thomas in New York. Good to hear you, sir.
Good evening, Gus. Good evening to all the callers. I'm sorry to hear about that, Rob. I know your living situation wasn't the best to start with, so sorry to hear about that. And what the cop said was true. I mean, it is something called an illegal eviction, but under the conditions where, you know, it could become hostile, I don't think that would be a good place. So I hope everything works out with you. For sure. I did have some commentary to make about tonight's show. And LeBron, very nice that he's putting some of his money and time into the children in his community where he was, and the place that white people allowed him to grow up at. And he got tweeted on, I don't know if that's, is that a metaphor, Gus? Can you get tweeted on? I mean, president himself says Don Lemon, one of the dumbest people in television, interviews LeBron James, and he's so dumb he made LeBron James sound smart, and that's hard to do. Only our president could put something out like that. Harvard, I'm a little in a disagreement. I don't think that Asians should be able to get financial aid or, I mean, not finance, but affirmative action treatment. I don't think whether they come from East, North, South, West, Asia, which includes Arabia, Europe, Africa, anywhere outside the United States, Mexicans, Islanders, South Americans, Canadians, I don't think any of them should be able to get affirmative action. It should only be given to people who are being classified as Black, who have a lineage of slavery and Jim Crow. And especially, I'm total disagreement with the number one and two recipients of affirmative action, which is white women and disabled white men. I don't think that they fit that classification of having to deal with Jim Crow and slavery, and they don't deserve it either. The report from the guy with Charlottesville, he was very inconsistent in what he was saying. He wasn't being honest. You know, I watched hundreds of hours of that riot on YouTube Live and other YouTube streams later for this last, you know, the week or two after, just hours of footage of what was going on there. And, you know, it was three different white groups that they merged into two. And that's one of the things that I noticed the media tries to do, because the third group of white supremacists were in the thousands, but they were just people there protesting. They weren't a member of Antifa, the white supremacist group, Antifa, or the other, you know, neo-Nazi and KKK groups that were there. But they tried to lump all of that together as Antifa. And I just would say that those two groups both came ready for combat. They came with fatigues on. They came in military formations. Both Antifa and the white supremacist groups. Both of them was guilty of going there with intent to cause harm against one another. And that's, that. I mean, from the start, that's how it looked. He didn't paint that picture. As a journalist, he's supposed to, but it seems like they're trying, like you said, Gus, they want to talk about the white girl who got mauled down by a car. She just went there with the Black Lives Matter. She wasn't a part of neither one of those groups. You know, they never showed us the good footage. Like, if you go to YouTube and look up that Charlottesville incident, you'll get good footage of what happened. The news didn't show us any of this stuff. I mean, so it didn't surprise me that this reporter was being very dishonest and ingenuous, even a year later, 2 years later. The woman who answered the question about the greater preservation of Black Lives Matter. It was something like that. I didn't like the way she came you know, it's, I think he acted, was this bigger than Black Lives Matter? And she went to, oh, yeah, this is about the evolution of humanity. I said, it just, she sounded very confused. Zimmerman was never put on trial. They put Trayvon, a dead child, on trial. That was so true. The ground was considered a deadly weapon, which is, you know, it wasn't Obama's fault. I don't blame him for what happened to, as far as Zimmerman's acquittal. I think that every time you see an unarmed person being that's being classified as black get gunned down by police, they always put that person on trial that got killed, and the police officer is never put on trial. That's just common practice. I know I'm running out of time, so I just came back from Las Vegas on vacation, and I did have some vacation racism on, all the way with a white woman spitting at my wife. I must say, I wasn't expecting. I didn't expect anywhere in the world. When you look at Dr. Welch's, who has, in my opinion, the most thorough definition of racism, because yours is great, but hers is clinical. It's about a paragraph long. But she says symbol formation. And I never thought anywhere was a more of a symbol formation of white supremacy other than New York and probably D.C., but Vegas blew me away. Another, that's a metaphor. Vegas, you know, it was number one, and I would like to talk about that later. Thank you, Gus.
Very interesting. That'll be curious once you share some of the symbols that you've seen. We have Red in Nevada, and I think some other folks who have hung out in Vegas to see if they too think that these symbols are, or if Vegas is saturated with white supremacy symbolism. Other folks we've not heard from.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Good evening to the callers and the host. This is Gio calling from Chicago, a.k.a. Chirac, a.k.a. the political machine. Okay, the corporal from Charlottesville. I noticed that they said the Marines didn't, when they first approached them with the charge, the Marines didn't take action until it gained momentum in the news. Standard operation. The interviewee, Gus, was he white or non-white, black?
You're talking about the Charlottesville, the interview where they were talking about Charlottesville?
Yeah.
The person
Correct.
Being interviewed, A.C. Thompson, is a white male. The person that was doing the interview, I am not certain. This was all audio. They didn't have any video with it, so I would have to, like, search to even find a picture of the person doing the interview, because I've never seen that person.
Okay. A.C. Thompson. Oh, wow. He sounded similar to the psychiatrist that you did the book study about with the psychopaths that was kind of intrigued by, like, by the acts when he was interviewing people, and then also the guy they offered him a new job, a new position, so that was interesting, that whole thing. And McCullen, I noticed that he mentioned with the Ferguson situation. I noticed that he mentioned with the drugs. He mentioned that we can change this thing tomorrow, but why? And I noticed that you always say that if whites want to do something about this problem, they can fix it within minutes, a matter of minutes. So that was interesting, an interesting observation. The Ferguson situation with, I think her name was Miss Saba, that has the documentary coming out. A lot of confusion with that. When she said she was she was trying to talk to the police officer, and he just like changed the subject, and the person from the media also got involved and changed it and started talking about baseball. Wow, the Voltron effect. I don't know if that's a metaphor, but yeah, that came to mind when I heard that, and the interviewer also Miss Saba. No, the interview that was with Miss Saba that talked to her, he also mentioned that she was privileged, and she said something that about her parents had hardships. So I was wondering where the privilege part was, and there was also an incident in Chicago, actually 2 days ago, where Chicago police were setting up a bait truck, 18-wheeler, where they would park it on the south side in Inglewood, and it would be an undercover cop in there. Across the street would be undercover cops, and there would be undercover cops parked down the block, and they were watching the truck and waiting for someone to get inside the truck, which they had boxes of Nike shoes, and hoping that they break in. They kind of had the door ajar. And someone was videotaping the whole incident. So that didn't happen on one of the first blocks. They attempted to drive down a couple blocks and parked. And that's when the people that were videotaping them, they came to the scene and questioned the police. And the police were nonchalant about the whole situation. They explained it. They said, well, you see this stuff on the news. They do it all the time with bait trucks and where they beat people. And as they were talking, going back and forth with the dialogue, a group of people started to come around. And they started chanting and yelling, saying, get out of our community. Community, that word, get out of our community, and you need to leave. And they were going back and forth with the police, and it was creating a big crowd, so the police just decided to leave. So and it's just something that they do all the time. This is nothing new that they do in Chicago, because they did it in the 90s with freight trains also, where they leave the door ajar, people would try to break in and they arrest them. Just attempts to arrest and lock people up, because at right now at the time, Cook County jails were at an all-time low for arrests. So I think they're trying to create that. I think that would probably be my 5 minutes, and I'll mute my line. Thank you.
Much obliged, sir. Every time I think of Chicago, I think, number one, cold. Gus T. Renegade can only visit Chicago between June and September. Too cold. And I think of Pam the Great, racismws.com. That's a great illustration, I think, of why Mr. Fuller suggests, as a part of his 10 stops, not stealing, that universal man, universal woman, that's what we should be striving to be, and that trying to be the best person we could possibly be, not a thief, even stealing from racists who have stolen everything from us, including stealing us, that we shouldn't even steal from them, not out of any, you know, trying to be moral, but just who do we want to be in the system of racism, white supremacy? They want us to be Negroes. They want us to steal because that helps their system. Then they can put the bait truck out. Who is it that we want to be in the system of racism, white supremacy? And who is it that we're going to need to be to end the system? I think that's the logic that he uses and why he encourages no stealing. And community, that word again, I'm glad you pointed it out. A community. You don't have to go out and yell and scream to get this bait truck out of your community. The community would be able to stop the bait truck from ever being there in the first place. That, at least that's my conceptualization of what a community is. Maybe people mean something else when they say that word. people we've not heard. Oh, and if we have anybody who saw the documentary, even if you just saw one or two parts, or if you saw the documentary on Michael Brown and Ferguson, definition of racism. If you saw those films, any portion, did you see here a definition of racism? I would appreciate that. Folks we've not heard from at all, commentary?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Hey, greetings, Gus, and callers and listeners. I just wanted to reach out to that brother that was going through it. When he was talking about he was sleeping in, you know, in some not so good situations. Cool. What I want to say to him, me and my wife had a conversation last night, and we argue that there's a difference between struggle and adversity. In life, you will always have adversity and struggle. They're synonymous. But to that brother, I want to tell, well, I know you don't like that word, brother. Okay, to that man, I would like to say, every day you on this side of the dirt, and that's not an analogy at all. Every time you on this side of the dirt, it's a good day. And you will make it, brother. And if you need to reach out to us, and, man, if we can help you in any way, man, we will. And love you, love, love, love. For real, for real. But then, Gus, to you, I wanted to ask if you were aware of this movie, this, you know, you got the, what do they call it, the Purge and all of that, and it's just so in our face. Now they have this movie coming out called the Darkest Minds, The Darkest Minds, and the guy gets, whoever the official is.
Hold on a second, sir. I got to make sure I'm consistent on this so that people do not email me with nasty commentary. We do not talk about films on the compensatory call-in just because in terms of priorities, I think entertainment gets a lot of attention. But we did hear the film Darkest Minds, so I have not.
I did not. Okay, sorry. I will not.
No apologies. But, okay, no apologies.
I'll omit all of that. But, I mean, what the guy said in this supposed commentary said, for your safety and their safety, bring us, surrender your children. And that's important. I mean, if we can't break protocol just this time for that, then okay, cool. But I'm just saying, wow. For their safety and your safety, please bring us your children. And, okay, I apologize. I didn't mean to bring in any, but this is what they're giving us, Gus. Come on, Gus. This is what they feeding us every day. So maybe we should revamp that because, geez, I mean, that's crazy. Thank you for taking my call, brother, and much love.
I did that. I was all right because I don't believe that I ever said that the word brother cannot be used on the program, although I certainly have, you know, my opinion about that. I would not be angry if it disappeared. However, I have asked not to be called brother. I think you did slip a reference to Gus as brother in there at the end. I have asked that that not be done. That notwithstanding, anyway, other folks, we have not much obliged for the commentary. And Robin, Wisconsin, that was the person that you were referencing, Robin, Wisconsin. If he wants to contact or what have you, I'm sure he's appreciative of your concern for his well-being, as I'm sure a lot of folks are concerned. Other folks that we've not heard from at all, if you have a hand up, line should be open. Proceed.
Can I be heard?
M. Hondisi?
Yes, sir.
Yes, sir.
Greetings to you, the host, the callers, and the listeners. I wanted to mention two things. The first thing was, in general, white people means, well, white people means white supremacy, and white supremacy means kill black people. White people means kill black people. So that's how I see it. And then the other thing is white people are not supposed to be here in this country at all, or they're not supposed to be in Africa or Australia or a lot of the other countries that they're in. And then so then the other thing is I heard Dr. Welsing say that a group of black psychologists got together and they made an agreement with it between themselves, or at least spoke about it between themselves, that, and I'm paraphrasing, but she said that if white people will stop white supremacy, then perhaps black people could ensure that white people's genetics stay intact, or that white people remain on the planet as albinos. And I wanted to ask Mr. Gus if you could, if you know about that, and if you could like explain that any further.
I don't know about that conference. And I truthfully can't say that I recall or have like memory of Dr. Welsing saying that. However, I have heard Mr. Fuller say that on more than one occasion. So it would not surprise me that, you know, this had happened. If it was black psychologists or some group of black people had such a conversation, that would not surprise me. But I haven't heard what you're talking about specifically. And it may have been that she said that Dr. Welsing said that. If somebody could find the audio, that would be grand to hear more details. But I've definitely heard Mr. Fuller say that on like several occasions, that verbatim, exactly what you just said, Imhan DC.
Okay, well, I thought it was Dr. Welsing. I mean, I thought that was her, but I'll see if I could find it myself. But I thought that was an interesting concept. I think that's something that, you know, we would have to actually agree on as a people, you know, as to what actually happens to these group of people who have called themselves white people who are killing black people. But yeah, I was just wondering about that. Thank you.
Yes, sir. If Mr. Fuller, I'm not sure if he said that on the cows or not. If you forced me to give a response, I would say no. I don't think he said that on a cows broadcast, but I have heard him say it more than once. It might be something that I have in my archives. I'll have to hope it does not take 2 years like the last time, but I'll try to listen. And if I can come across the audio of him saying, because I've heard him say that like multiple times, like not a one. I feel like I could just listen randomly and would probably hear him saying that at some point, Mr. Fuller. I'm talking, or you could just call him directly or call into the compensatory his program there. You could call in there and ask him directly about whether or not he has said such a thing, or just ask him now what he thinks about that. And he could give you his 2018 perspective on it. Do either or. Other folks that we've not heard from at all.
May I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you for allowing me to share. This is Red in Nevada. Definitely very interested in what Thomas from New York, the symbols that he said that he saw when he was in Las Vegas. I know that mainly the symbols that I see is a lot of glorification of the Eurocentric beauty standard, literally everywhere. I know that I have to do a lot of self-talk to make sure that I don't start thinking that that is the standard as well. And then, like I said before, there's like the Las Vegas strong, there's no real definition of what that actually means. And then also a lot of the gun rights and things like bumper stickers and things of that nature, just talking about, you know, buying, selling guns, stuff like that, and the weed pictures and paraphernalia, stuff like that. The things that I wanted to share about the clips were, I thought the reporter during, or I'm sorry, in the, or the interviewer in the segment talking about Charlottesville, and I think you said that was A.C.
Thompson.
I forgot his last name. Thompson, sorry. A.C. Thompson. I definitely thought that he might have been practicing racism, especially when he first described the white terrorists. I feel like in the beginning when he was describing the white terrorists or the one who ran over the white woman who got killed, who people are like making her into a martyr, he called him either a young man or a gentleman. And he was like, well, you know, well, that was the rally or whatever, where the young man ran over the Heather Heyer or whatever. He either said young man or the gentleman. So I just like, you know, you're still, this is somebody who killed somebody, but yes, you still have to stay on code. Also, in that same segment, when A.C. Thompson was talking about, I think his name was DeAndre, or his name is DeAndre Harris, and he said that he was charged with assault based on theory. I definitely thought that that was really important. So there's video and everything, but just based on theory, them, and that's why they charged him with assault, because they felt like he would fight back. Even though white people are not ignorant to racism, they have taught black people to not fight against them, even if white people are being outwardly racist. So I still just thought that that was interesting. The Who Street. I did see that actually with, because I do unfortunately have cable for some reason, but I did see that that was kind of like one of the things that was one of the documentaries that was advertised. And I thought that was interesting because they have, usually when they speak about Trayvon Martin, they always have like the black and white picture of them. The main thing that they'll have is the black and white picture of him, like the close up with his face and the hood. And that was the picture that they had. I'm assuming that's what she selected. But I already knew when I saw that I couldn't mentally take the, you know, watching that type of thing. And just, I was just also thinking, like, there's a pretty sizable white or at least non-black population, I feel like, within Nevada. So I thought that it was interesting how that would be something that they would really advertise, and it makes you think, well, you know, this is going back into like Gus's theory about Negro trauma drama, and how that is like something that white people like to consume visually. Hopefully that's not a metaphor. The last thing, nothing too much. I've not been as far as like the my studies of constant looking up different things about the opioid quote-unquote epidemic. I'm only seeing just mainly about how like the House of Representatives, they are kind of questioning pharmaceutical companies, but not necessarily seeing any like real legislation or wanting them to really be held quote-unquote accountable, because you would think that these are the people who can hold somebody accountable for their actions about contributing to the death of other suspected white supremacist criminals because they are taking drugs illegally. So just seeing that, where they're just only asking questions, but not really putting forth anything. No one's being brought to, you know, court or even fined. So just wanted to bring that up, and thank you for allowing me to share.
Negro trauma drama. That is one of the great products of the atrocity, The Hate U Give. That is where that phrase was coined. And absolutely, necrophilia. I think whites, they love, it's like they get to experience the lynching all over again. They get to ridicule Rachel Gentile all over again. Other folks that we've not heard from at all, if you have a hand up, proceed.
Hello.
Yes, ma'am.
Hi, can I be on? Oh, hi. Gus. This is Bethamania. I can wait. Go ahead.
Yeah, it's about three people at once. I was going, I think the first person actually was our female caller at 7656. I think she actually was first.
I can wait. It's no big deal.
Much obliged. Draftomania, did you want to proceed?
Hi, Gus, and the rest of the callers. I just wanted to, send my, just was going for the brother, for Rob in his housing situation. I can definitely identify. I have gone through displacement and dislocation on many occasions, and actually where I'm placed at right now as a result of a dislocation, a situation that I ended up in, that ended up happening to me. And I wanted to pose a question to the family, Kyle's family. Where I'm living at now, I have to share, the space, share space like the kitchen with some race soldiers that I stay with, right? And I just wanted to pose a question like how they were handled, because this is something that had came up before where it was like, I was somewhat being harassed, and I just wanted to try to learn how to strategize in case, the situation happens again, because it's about that time when they're about to have new residents and stuff move in. So if you guys were sharing a space like the kitchen with suspected race soldiers, and you were cooking your food, and there was some, they kept, like, somebody kept bringing a bunch of people in the kitchen while you were cooking around your food, how would you handle it? And how would you also handle, like, if you were being rushed out of the kitchen, like somebody was constantly trying to make it seem like they, asking you every time they seen you in the kitchen, are you cooking? Even though they saw you cooking, it's like it becomes like a harassment type of deal. And then next, to move on to some of the commentary that I heard tonight, I just wanted to commend LeBron James for the school that he opened up, and that especially for the free college tuition for the students after they complete the high school. I thought that was commendable. And Donald Trump's tweets and regarding his, opening up the school, I feel that they're very petty, childish, and it's just basically he's just practicing white supremacy. And, other than him spending that time, wasting, time being petty on worrying about sports stars, he could be spending time on, like, maybe something constructive, like trying to figure out how Flint is going to get clean water. Flint is still living like a third. I don't know if this is a, what do you call it, metaphor, a third world country, still living like some places like in India and things like that, where they don't even have clean water, and this is supposed to be the United States of America, but he can spend time, wasting time on tweeting about unnecessary things. Regarding the Charlottesville issue, today, I'm not sure, I'm quite sure you got, that today they had the rally over in Oregon, Portland, Oregon. And basically the same thing, there have been conflicts and scuffles between the non-fascist groups and the white supremacist groups. So that was a big thing going in today. So I thought that that clip was, basically somewhat coincided with exactly what was going on. And I'm quite sure that was, I'm quite sure you did that on purpose because you know what was going on today. But there is like a lot of scuffles and a lot of fights going on. And from what I witnessed from the news, it seemed like it was a lot of that going on between white people. It was like basically fighting each other. So, I'm not really sure what that's about. But, the guy, whoever the guy was, A.C. Thomas or whoever it was, they were talking about, these white supremacists seem to be very organized, as he was talking about, and how these groups came together with over like close to 1,000 groups of white supremacists that came together in military and tactical, and they were military and tactically skilled. And that just goes to show us that like we really need to kind of like get our stuff together, because they are not playing. Like when they get together, they are like, they are organized. They were able to form a line just like that and be, start the march and do everything what they like, what they needed to do. And we, you know, due to white supremacy and being so confused, we can't even like handle certain things, you know, simple things. So that's just like, that's kind of just, you know, stood out to me. And also with the issue with Michael Brown, rest in peace, Michael Brown, and a conflict with the young lady that was talking about the conflict in Ferguson, and how, you know, the police presence and the whole rioting caused us non-white people to have PTSD. And, you know, and I think that, you know, basically that's exactly what white supremacy and racism does.
30
seconds. It causes mental illness in our communities, and that's all I have. I'll mute my line, and thank you, Beth.
Much obliged, Draftomania. The caller at 7656. Did you want to proceed?
Hold on just a second. Let me get my timer started. Beta, thank you so much for taking my call. Hope everyone's having a good evening. First, to the young lady who's Draftomania, with the food situation, I know it's not best, but this may be the time to have processed foods like those healthy choice dinners or something where you're in and out the kitchen very quickly, and bottled water. Those are just basic. Again, I know that's not the best food, but just to avoid so you can get your own permanent place. Thank you to Rob for calling. I know it's difficult to go through what you go through, but the fact that you are still going through it and think that we can help you in any way is, you know, that's, you know, you don't have to tell us anything, and the fact that you think we can help you, I feel, you know, useful, and thank you for that. Again, I hope everything does get better. My mom is becoming a little bit more aware of activities. She loves to tell me about the Living While Black activities. I guess they're on Facebook a lot, so she tells me about those. There was one, or the young lady at school, another one at school, and then I read one, I think, on Black Talk Radio, a young woman trying to help a homeless person who I think might have been white because she was feeding a dog, and how that worked out. So, again, not only do they want to tell us about the living, the dying, the black people dying, Negro trauma drama, but just living while black everyday activities, they like to bring those up as well. I guess I reminded my uncle of the program because we were talking yesterday about it. He was like, oh, I heard of that. So I'm supposed to send him more information about that. The documentaries, I know you don't want to watch them. I don't either. And the Living While Black little segments, I really don't want to see those either. But if the people are really working, like they say, to develop some kind of case, some human rights case, the documentaries can be constructive in that area because the evidence from the black people putting videos and things together. So it can be positive if someone's using it for that purpose. The book, I heard a little bit of it yesterday. I know they use, I guess, the language of the man, Mr. Forgot his name. Cujo something. When you read something like that, I can kind of read something like that, but I don't like to hear it because it always sounds like they're making fun of the person when they're speaking that language, and the person is very serious about what he or she is talking about. So sometimes it's like that. I'd rather read them than hear them for that purpose. Intelligence gathering at work, I believe that's what the white man was doing, the white people in the military, things like that. So we always have to be able to do that, no matter what type of job we have, if we can gather any intelligence to help us solve this problem, because as I think we state on this show a lot, we are at war. It's not a metaphor. We are at war. They are trying to kill us. Code switching, I thought that was interesting that that's the segment when they talk about race and things like that, NPR, that they use the term code switching, which I know is a term used in the New American Classic, The Hate U Give. And I know it's been used by black people before. It was mentioned in that book. And I just think it's weird that they use that when they focus on things. Well, not weird. It's interesting that they use those on things focusing around non-white people. And there's a reason for that, because if they talk plain to everyone, they could probably solve a lot of problems. Liz. I think that I got everything. Yes, that's all I wanted to say right now. Thank you.
Much obliged. She said the new American classic. Woo, I am wounded. Other folks that we have not heard from at all, if you have a hand up, proceed. Can't lollygag today because there are other folks who we have not heard from at all. So it'd be better if you go ahead and speak up if you do have a hand up commentary to share. Yes, sir. Our call in Florida. Your volume is a little low. If you could speak up, that would be grand.
Yes, sir. Can you hear me, Gus?
Yes, sir.
Nice. Thank you very much, sir. Greetings to Gus, the host, the listeners, and callers. I wanted to start out with how I picked up on certain terms, why I focused on certain terms. The first one being fascist. It seems like white supremacists are trying to utilize that word to replace the word racist. It does. I think it's spelled out in a similar way, fascist, because in that one segment, I think they were referring to Antifa as being the anti-fascist group of white people and how they were opposed to, supposedly opposed to, the people that they, of course, call white supremacist groups. And it reminded me of when Trump, he pretty much said, well, hey, there's good people on both sides. Could mean white people on both sides, I'm thinking maybe. Or when they mentioned how the guy, the white guy, he pretty much ran over the white woman with the car, and just a lot of confusion that was going on with that, in my opinion. It does seem like those two terms are very similar. There was another segment where I believe it was the God, what I was going to say on that. If I could just think on it for a second, I can just give it to the next person. Thanks, Gus, for allowing me to share.
No problem. Take your time. There are other folks to chat while you think. It'll come back to you, I'm sure, as soon as you take a moment. Other folks that we've not heard from at all, if you have a hand up, proceed.
Can I be heard?
Retired firefighter in Florida. Yes, sir.
Greetings, everyone. I would like to announce that this past Monday at approximately 2:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, my attempted mother died. Basically, I look at it as a feeling of relief for her, as well as her five offspring. She was born in the place that is called Georgia, and for the moment of her birth, she was born under the global system of racism, white supremacy. The terrorism of that particular place and time was, it was called sharecropping. And when she managed to escape from that plantation, she came to South Florida, met my attempted father, and from that relationship started producing children, with me being the third of five. I would say since 1954, she's accomplished a lot of things, but the main thing I would say about her legacy was she committed herself to her five children. As far as counseling, raising, that sort of thing, under this global system of racism, white supremacy, it is very difficult to accomplish that. And I would say, as a victim of racist white supremacy, and under those circumstances, she did probably the best job that a person can under these war conditions. And I will always be internally grateful that the Creator chose her to be the passageway for my birth, and also care that she administered. Other than that, just examining the business, of death, in the funeral home, funeral director, just like most black people, you're going to have, you know, most of these people are going to be non-white black. Because as Mr. Fuller said, white people do not want to have anything to do with preparing black people for funerals. But so anyway, black male, and they were kind of like, I'm trying to think of a name for it, nervous jabbering, you know, about things because of the, I think because of the nature of the business itself, you know, people are not volunteering to come into a funeral home. They come in for a particular service that no one is looking forward to. So anyway, my mother's five children, we're in the funeral home doing business. And with one of the other employees, the funeral director started describing some incident that he was involved in high school, where the other guy he was talking to, they were kind of like joking about the idea of how he grew up. He grew up in a side of town down here in South Florida where he was one of the few, if not the only black family that was in that part of town. And he went to high school and was confronted by some non-white black males who, I'm trying to copy the phrase that this person brought up, we're going to beat you into being black again, something like that, something of that nature. And so they gave him a time when that was going to take place during the school day, I think preferably after the school day. And yes, he was confronted after school, but who comes to the rescue? His white buddies. And he mentioned, he said that it was a pickup truck with rebel flags all over it, and came to his rescue and got out the truck and basically threatened the non-white black males with violence, I assume, put him in the pickup truck and sped off into the sunset. And I didn't really react to it at all. I didn't say anything at all. I was just said to myself, interested. But that's all I have to report. Trust me, it's a feeling of relief. My mother lived for 90 years. She was quite productive in what she said and did during that period of time. And so I don't have anything to be sad for. And thank everybody who all the while was in prayer and also in mentioned to me during the period of time of her health. And that's all I have to say. Thank you.
Thank you, retired firefighter. And certainly, Cal's listeners will be thanking, praying for a retired firefighter, his family, passing of your mother, 90 years. That is impressive, given all of the terrorism I'm sure she endured in the system of white supremacy, Florida and Georgia terrorism, no less. We had a listener who wrote in. She said this is a West Coast victim. West Coast victim, black female in California. Yikes. Oof. Let me make sure I get my sound effect together on this one. Yikes. This is West Coast victim, black female married to a white male. Oof. Suspected white supremacist. She wrote that in. Suspected white supremacist. Still tragic. I just wanted to report an incident that occurred today as I was out on my morning walk with my children, 1 and 3 years. One of my toddlers, the 4-year-old, walked into the driveway of our apartment complex where our cars came in and out. I'm actually going to pause the report right here because we just had a listener write in on Thursday, and we had a victim of racism. And he said that one of his friends is a black male who is also in a tragic arrangement. And we had a listener write in and said, you know, why are you even maintaining contact with this person if they're in a tragic arrangement? And folks gave, you know, responses. Ivy, myself, I think there were some other people who gave responses on the program about why you would maintain contact. I certainly would. I don't see the logic, I'll put it that way. If you have someone like the person who wrote in who admits to being in a tragic arrangement, I don't see the logic of just scorning them if they are attempting to learn about racism, white supremacy, or to exchange views with you specifically about racism, white supremacy. I don't see the point of scorning them if they are attempting to learn and having courteous dialogue and even being truthful that, oh yeah, my husband, my wife, suspected white supremacist. Why would you, you know, say that this person has to be totally muted, never talk to that person again? I don't see the logic of that, but maybe I'm still confused myself. So we'll start again. Victim of white supremacy, tragic arraignment. I just wanted to report on an incident that occurred today as I was out on my morning walk with my children, 1 and 3 years. One of my toddlers, the 4-year-old, walked into the driveway of our apartment complex where cars come in and out. The suspected racist white woman walking her dog behind us, who was watching me and my children the entire time, began to chuckle when my toddler followed me into the street as a car was approaching. She quickly became more codified and said, "I'm surprised. They usually don't stop." I ignored her and kept walking as I knew the racist woman was fantasizing about my child getting hit by a car and was more than likely laughing at me being an attempted black parent. Had I done it differently, I would have told the white woman that the difference between her and I is that if her dog would have ran into the street, I would have been instinctively concerned. But I always seem to think of the perfect response when it's too late. They will give you other opportunities. I have known all white people are racist going on 3 years now, mainly from the works of a suspected white supremacist. I've learned a great deal about white supremacy on this program, and it still amazes me how confused I was and still am. We are still learning. Addendum. We saw the woman a few minutes later, and because I ignored her the first time she spoke, she made sure to speak louder and let me know how cute my kids are. When white people tell me how cute my kids are, sometimes I retort with, "Thank you, Black Lives Matter." That's funny. What else can I do, say, to reject white people's compliments, which they only give in attempt to hide their racism? Now, this is a question, so it seems she might want feedback. I think you can invoke response number one and ignore that too. I think that works even better, especially if she saw that she had to intensify and exert more energy to try to get your attention. I'm not going to give you even that. Like, I have nothing to say. Might even just give you eye contact along with my mute silence and continue on about my business. Like, yeah, I don't think you are required to exert a syllable, but that's just me. Other folks can give their own thoughts. People we've not heard from at all. If you have a hand up and you have commentary to share, you should definitely speak now. Do not lollygag.
May I be heard?
Let's see. Codified software developer in Wisconsin.
Oh, thank you. I'll try to be brief here. I'm going to start my timer. To Rob, I'm sorry that you're going through that. I thought Kim Steele's suggestions were very constructive. Also, I know you may not want to hear this, but the rescue mission is an option, but it's probably an option of last resort, but it is available. And to the retired firefighters, my condolences for you, sir. I just had a grandmother go through hospice care. She lived to be 98, and she went through hospice care and passed in May. So my condolences for you as well. I had a counter-racist T-shirt experiment report to give tonight. So I'll just give you some highlights here. So I went to this this conference, this knitting conference today with my mother and my aunt. My mother also had a counter-racist hit. She had the same cow's T-shirt on, and we went there. And there were some interesting experiences that we had there, most notably a non-white, quote-unquote, Hispanic male, but he was definitely non-white. He was melanated. He says, I love your shirt. It's so awesome. There were two suspected racists speaking to him at this booth, and they started speaking to him about, well, they started talking and joking with him about white people mistreating him at the job. So I thought that was interesting. At that same booth, I did buy something, and I counted out my money, but it was a dollar short. I then he said, oh, you're fine. And there was a white male there as well who had seen the shirt. He said, oh, you're fine. I pulled out a dollar, and I'm like, here's the dollar. Oh, no, it's fine. Go ahead. You know, I thought that was really interesting. There was a white female who read my shirt and laughed. Then she tried to give me a hug, which I rebuffed. She then said, I'm sorry you feel that way. I replied, I don't feel anyway. It's not about feelings. She then said, well, I'm sorry people have treated you that way in a slightly perturbed voice. And I said, So I was at another booth looking around, and a white male said, your shirt is amazing. I asked, what's so amazing about it? He replied, well, I'm from Portland, and the quality of activism is huge there. It's a great statement. Now, I didn't say anything, but I think to myself, is this the same Oregon that had Portland, Oregon? And is this in the same state that had all those black exclusion laws? That was very interesting. Another white woman walked up to me and said said the shirt was amazing. I asked her what was so amazing about it. She said, I love the sash. My friend needs one of these shirts. She's always saying, treat me like I am a mediocre white man. Now, I consider this a racist act, as she totally removed white women from the conversation and just placed it solely on white men. Let's see. Another white woman came up to me. She said, I like your shirt. I said, what do you like about it? She said, well, it confronts white people and forces them to think about how they don't treat you like a white person. So she was saying this in such a way where she was talking like she wasn't white. So I asked her directly. I said, are you white? And she said, yes. That's why I wasn't sure if I could say that I liked your shirt. I appreciate the forward nature of it. Two black women read our shirts and started laughing. One said she liked the shirt and a look on my mom's face. And this victim looked like she was in a tragic arrangement until the white male then walked up to her asking for her phone. Finally, two white women stopped me on the way out to tell me how much they loved my shirt. One asked where I got it from, and I just said from a podcast, and I didn't elaborate. The other one was with three other females, one of whom was black, and she said how great it was. Then she turned to the black female and said, did you see their shirts? Aren't they great? And the black female smiled and nodded but looked a bit uncomfortable. Non-white people didn't really engage us. Many non-white people avoided eye contact. There were a few black females who were friendly. Also, as a side note, I noticed several racist suspects selling, like, wares from the African continent and India and claiming to do missionary work. I did not purchase anything from those booths. With that, I'll mute my line. Thank you.
Fantastic. Thank you so much, Ivy, for being patient. But, wow, fantastic. So rich the content. I'm sorry that the shirt almost got you molested by a hugging white woman. Oh, the horror. But Wow, that is fantastic. Sounds like you got some great questions. I do not feel outstanding codified software developer in Wisconsin. Ivy, did you have commentary? Yes, I got the funds for the investment. Much obliged, much obliged, much obliged. Thank you for your patience yielding to codified software developer.
Member?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Yeah, absolutely. You're welcome, Gus. And man, if I could help it, I'd never go ahead of the codified software developer. And as usual, she was so codified on so many levels. I have other notes, so I won't go into it, but y'all all heard it. Man, for the retired firefighter, I will continue to be praying for you. And, you know, it seems like your mom was just such a great person. And from what you described and from what I've observed, it just seems like she raised a very strong, wise firefighter. So Robin, Wisconsin, I agree with the woman who spoke earlier, who, you know, thanked you. You know, thank you so much for just, you know, being so transparent and just sharing, because I know that that's very difficult, and I look forward to hearing about improvement, just developments of just your improvement, because I agree with Ken that, you know, things will get better, and I certainly hope that they do sooner than later. I wanted to say that they now, you know, races, they use, you know, LGBT, which is lesbian, gay, and all that. They got away from the word homosexuality, I think, because they know that that speaks to a perversion of sexuality. They got away from transvestite and now use transgender for the same reason, I think, because they know that that speaks to a perversion of sexuality. They got away from child molester and started using pedophile. To me, pedophile is not as clear as a child molester. Well, the thing is, you know, and I say that to say I use homosexual, I use transvestite, I don't use any of these lesbian, gay, and all these other transgender, none of that. And I don't use child molester, but I use something similar. Now I don't use pedophilia anymore. I use child rape, because in my view, even if it doesn't involve penetration, any sexual contact where the person is not able to consent, to me, that's rape. As far as the Trayvon Martin documentary and Michael Brown Jr., which, Gus, I'm so glad you always say Michael Brown Jr. I can't really go into it, but it's just a great way to address him, and I know that that's his full name, but it really, to me, it just comes off as just more respectful than Mike Brown, or, you know, even Michael Brown, which Michael Brown is fine, but just Michael Brown Jr., just to me, it's just more humanizing and respectful and honorable and honoring. But with those documentaries, it's interesting. I think Draptomania pointed this out, that they, just like you said, Gus, that they like to see that. And a proof of that is when they used to take pictures and put them on postcards. So it's like these videos are now their postcards. They don't have to do that. As far as what you said, Gus, about, man, I was saying the same thing when you said that you don't see the logic in distancing yourself from people who are more confused. I don't either. If you want to solve this problem, it's just like you said with Dr. Welvin, that she told you that the people who are less confused about racism and have any significant understanding about it, it's just way less than 1%. It's so small. And it's like we have to have way more than that if we're going to solve the problem. Well, that's not going to happen if we distance ourselves, you know, from people who are, you know, more confused, I guess, than we are. And it's just like the person who wrote in who says she's married to a suspected Klan member. I realize every day how confused I am just from really listening to this program a lot. For the most part, I agree with you also about that she should ignore. Like, if they try to go through more and more ways to get her attention, that she should ignore all the more. I totally agree with that. And I just want to say, Gus, that, you know, in a couple of minutes, I wish you a very happy birthday for, you know, just the whole day, as best as you can have. And that's all I had on mute my line. Thanks, everyone. Thanks, Gus.
Man, I am prepped for the foolishness at yoga class tomorrow. Man, have my defenses high. Not a metaphor, literally. Defenses will be high for tomorrow. Class is at high noon, no less. Are there any folks that we missed completely? Anybody has a hand up that we have not heard from at all? Oh, we got everybody. That is spectacular because I was a little nervous. Did we nab all the folks that have a hand up? I think I don't see any hands that I missed. I think, did we miss it? Caller in Florida who works at the courthouse, did you remember what you were going to share, sir?
Yes, sir. Can I be heard?
If you could speak up a bit, that would be helpful.
Can you hear me?
Yes, sir.
All right, thank you, sir. I just wanted to point out a few more instances or observations with the LeBron James clip. I noticed that, I believe, the statement he made in the news and VGQ, of course, was about, I guess, something about dividing us, or Trump was using sports to divide us. That definitely does sound like language that we've been indoctrinated with from racist white supremacists, and it can become very confusing when you're using a word like divide and division and stuff, because even in sports, you have two groups who are competing that can be seen as a form of a division or a divide, so it doesn't seem very clear. And there's another term that I hear often from victims when it comes to addressing racism, white supremacy. They'll say, we don't want to make this a black and white issue. Really, I've heard white people say that. And that's not really clear either, because it's implying that black people have the same amount of ability and power to do to white people as what white people have been historically. And in the present, they're doing to us. So that's like it. I don't know if anybody else thought of that, but that's what I was thinking about on that term when they say we don't want to make it a black and white issue. And that's a metaphor, too. It's not all in black and white. And that was pretty much the only other thing that I had to add on to my commentary. And thanks for allowing me to share.
Words are very important. Very. Vickas, who co-hosts Reckless 2.0, he's been a longtime listener, investor, and attempted counter-racist himself. He asked if I had seen the new documentary on Jonestown. Speaking of black death, necrophilia, he asked if I saw the new documentary on Jonestown. I have not. However, a cute listener that I know has seen some of this footage and was talking about this. Now, my interest was piqued because Dr. Welsing, she used to reference Jonestown on a regular basis for a lot of reasons. In fact, when Imhan Dissi was sharing earlier, I thought he was going to talk about when Dr. Welsing was saying that she and some other, I believe it was black psychologists, they were trying to get access to evidence because a lot of black people died in Jonestown. We don't have any time to talk about that in detail, but that is a lengthy bit, but worthy of study. We talked about it before on the program. Anyway, Jim Jones. Anyway, she said that she and other colleagues, they were going to try to get evidence, autopsy reports from the victims, but they were denied access to this information, I believe, by a high-ranking government agency. I think she's talked about this before. Again, not sure if this was in her 31 visits on the cows or other works, but I suspect this is something she's probably referenced more than once. I think she might have talked about this on the cows. Might be willing to put a wager that she did. Anyway, Jonestown is something that I have referenced. There are a lot of documentaries and books written about this event that took place in the 70s. Apparently, there's a new documentary. The listener that I referenced, she said that she thought it had interesting material, and I think Vickas did as well. I have not seen it. Has anybody seen the new Jonestown material? I reckon not. I reckon not. Well, if I get an opportunity to view it, I'll post a link and share a thought. But that was a subject of interest for Dr. Welsing. She talked about it on a regular basis. Seattle had aircraft flying over the city for the past 3 days. It was supposed to be a part of an air show, military aircraft. I tweeted about it a couple days ago. Just whites constantly glorifying machines, weapons of mass destruction and death constantly. But it was massively annoying for me because it was so loud. And I mean, like, ear splitting pain loud. In fact, it went over today so loud that it set off car alarms on the street. And this is part of a major air show that I guess they have every summer in Seattle. But constantly whites find, oh man, we missed symbolism. Talk about symbolism of white supremacy. Thomason, New York. What is the Las Vegas symbolism? Red in Nevada and I were anxiously awaiting. What is the symbolism that you saw while on vacation? Viva Las Vegas.
Yeah, well, first symbolism, Gus, is all black people serving rich white people. The average store on the strip is Louis Vuitton, Prada, Gucci. It's nothing that black people go to. But who's working in all the stores, who's serving people in all the restaurants but black people? And I thought that was stood out quite vividly when we first landed. It's the symbolism of Rome. You have Caesar, who never existed, in his fake palace that they reinvented there to keep that symbolism going. That's all literature. That's not real. The Palazzo with their talc waterfalls and fountains that was built by black Europeans, not white Europeans. The Bellagio with their hanging gardens that never existed, but that's just a literary function that reinforces the system of white supremacy. The Venetian, they did Venice, which was built by black Europeans, not white Europeans. The MGM Park, Monaco, once again, Monaco, Monte Carlo, rather, which is in Monaco, that's built by black Europeans, not white Europeans. They reinvented Egypt with fake hieroglyphs, with white faces. They gave you the Ptolemaic Egypt, the Islamic-style fake little Egyptian hotel. So they even bought in that. Just all these are symbols of white supremacy. The medieval castle, they called the Excalibur. There was something pristine during medieval times. Read their history. You'll see that you didn't want to be around during medieval time. They built Paris, equipped with the Eiffel Tower. They built New York, equipped with the Empire State Building and the Statue of Liberty. I'm like, every symbol of white supremacy is right here in one spot. I stayed at the Treasure Island that had a pirate theme. Of course, you know, the real pirates were original Americans. They had dreadlocks like Johnny Depp tries to present. The MGM Grand with their lions on display, the Mirage with their tiger show, the Mandalay Bay with their shark show, all predators, the white people showing you symbolism that we're the apex predator because we captured them and we got them in our show. The homelessness there was terrible. People walking around, endless amounts of alcohol. They're just picking up cups of beer people dropped or whatever put down. Just terrible. A lot of crime. I saw someone get robbed at a casino. A white guy got robbed by a black guy. He put his phone down, gave his friends a high five. Black dude snatched the phone, did a dip move, and they went running after him. But, you know, he knew the casino, so he knew where to get out at. White woman came up to my wife and said, oh, we just love your skin tone. And they just started conversation. I thought that was interesting. They started the conversation that way. Another white woman came up to my wife in the pool. I was standing next to her. And she said, I just learned how to swim. I just put my head under the water for the first time ever. And she gave my wife a high five. So my wife put her hand out, you know, and she put her hand out for high five or whatever. And then she went on to say, this is what caught me. Her sister-in-law is black. And she told me that black people don't know how to swim. Can you swim? Can your husband swim? So my wife's like, yeah, you know, and, you know, why you don't want to get your hair wet? And just a lot of questions I thought was very interesting. And a white woman, a homeless white woman, walked up to us while we were walking on the strip, and they were having a show with the fire and stuff that come out the ground. And it was a bunch of people around, and she just started screaming something at my wife. So, you know, we kind of, like, moved away from her, and she came back and spit. And a little bit of her spit got on my wife's pocketbook, and then my wife kind of, you know, wanted to go after her, but she disappeared in the crowd. And, you know, I told her that would, you know, you'll be the only one out here looking a fool, you know, let's just keep it moving. But terrible as far as that goes. Other than that, I did like it. And I'll mute my line. Thank you.
Viva Las Vegas. Wow, that is not a place I would want to go for vacation for a myriad of reasons. But excellent observations, symbolism in that wretched area of the planet. I'm glad you all were able to get out safely. I am a big advocate of minimize contact. It is amazing how whites will just strike up conversation with black people out in public and get you to just start conversing with them and supporting them or whatever it is. Like, they are very good at that sort of thing out in public. Be mine. Again, that's why I'm a big advocate of you don't have to respond at all. Many times that is the best response. Nothing. With that, we will call it a broadcast. Much obliged to all the folks who participated. I hope it was or participated, listened, either or. Much obliged. Hope it was worthy of your time and energy. We will be back next week. Check Black Talk Radio Network, Facebook, Twitter. You'll get the updates for when we'll be doing our next broadcast. Please be safe for the weekend. Man, race soldiers, they do not take breaks or holidays just because the weather is nice and we want to enjoy the rest of our summer. If you're going to be out frolicking, great. Have a lot of fun. Have as much fun as you can. You still want to be codified. I think that should include sobriety would be best under conditions of white terrorism. Dr. Welsing and many of the folks we esteem, they would strongly encourage, let's be sober and protect our brain computer so we can think of solutions to permanently solve the problem, racist man, racist woman, racist child. In addition to being sober, every single time that we are in a vehicle, buckle up. Let's do all that we can to minimize contact with race soldiers, badge or no. That said, Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cow signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim, your brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
Shut I'm up. A victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my condition. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.